I was gambling on all sorts of things, and I lost 25 grand in a night.
If these dangers were known about for decades, why were so many patients and families left in the dark? Impulsive starts this afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 16th of February. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. The headlines this morning. The government is setting out plans to act more quickly to bolster children's safety online and warning tech giants they won't get a free pass. Will it work in a constantly shifting online world? We'll be talking to the Technology Secretary about that at 8:10. The BBC has learned that the Prime Minister is considering a significant increase in defence spending.
Also in today's programme, not one but two gold medals for Team GB on snow and ice.
He comes into the Adeleo, into the finish, and it is gold for Great Britain!
Skeleton racers Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker wake up this morning Olympic champions. They'll join us on the programme at 10 to 8. There's a big row underway about the fairness of student loans in this country, so do the repayments need rethinking? We'll put that to the man who came up with the model at 7:30. And we'll hear from the opera singer celebrating her 81st birthday this week, performing Wagner in the nude. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Chris Aldridge.
The government is pledging to respond more quickly to close loopholes in laws designed to protect children online. Sir Keir Starmer says technology is moving really fast and no online platform will get a free pass. Campaigners and bereaved parents have welcomed the news, but opposition parties say ministers are not moving quickly enough to ban under-16s from social media, describing a consultation due to begin next month as inaction. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
The Online Safety Act was written before the release of AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. The government says it intends to close loopholes in the legislation so the tech is included. Amendments will also be made to the Crime and Policing Bill to ensure chatbots protect users from illegal content. New rules aim to speed up coroners informing Ofcom about the death of a child so the regulator can order tech companies to preserve their data if it's relevant to how they died. A public consultation begins next month on a possible social media ban for under-16s, restricting their access to AI chatbots and limiting infinite scrolling. The government says it will respond quickly, but critics are concerned this could mean government giving itself powers to change laws without due process. While the wheels were already in motion for some of the measures announced today, they're a clear sign from Downing Street that protecting children online remains a top priority.
The BBC has learned the Prime Minister is considering making a significant increase in defence spending. Downing Street is exploring the idea of meeting an existing spending target earlier than planned at a potential cost of billions of pounds. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has the story.
The government aims to spend 2.5% of national wealth on defence by 2027, with an ambition of reaching 3% in the next parliament. I understand the Prime Minister's considering reaching 3% earlier, potentially by the end of this parliament. His aim? To cover existing defence costs and to meet future challenges. He told the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, "We're going to have to spend more faster to meet the wider threat." But this would be expensive, and that would mean more taxes, borrowing, or cuts elsewhere. Downing Street said no decisions had been made about the defence investment plan.
BBC News understands that the front-runner to become the government's most senior civil servant was spoken to about her management and leadership style after an inquiry into a complaint against her. Dame Antonia Romeo is currently one of three people sharing the role of Cabinet Secretary on a temporary basis. An investigation into a single complaint against her in 2017 found there was no case to answer. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
In 2017, Dame Antonia Romeo was investigated after a single complaint made allegations of bullying and about her use of expenses. The BBC has seen a letter sent by the government's head of HR at the time that told her there was no case to answer. But a source said there were tough conversations with Dame Antonia at the time about her leadership style. It comes after the former head of the Foreign Office, Lord MacDonald, made an unusual intervention last week, telling Channel 4 News more due diligence was needed if Antonia Romeo was to be appointed Cabinet Secretary. A Cabinet Office spokesperson said, Antonia Romeo is an outstanding leader with a 25-year record of excellent public service.
The Conservatives are calling on Labour to suspend its links with a prominent think tank after it commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of a number of journalists. Labour Together, which helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership, asked the US lobbying firm ACPO in 2023 to look into the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times story about the think tank's donations. The group's leader at the time, Josh Simons, who's now a Cabinet Office Minister, has said ACPO strayed beyond its brief. BBC Panorama has found evidence suggesting that a man who spent 23 years in prison for murder was framed by the police. 13 witnesses have told the programme they were pressured to exaggerate their statements or lie at the trial of Omar Benghit. In their response, Dorset Police didn't directly address the suggestion that officers had framed Benghit, but said their investigation had been thorough, detailed and very complex. Bruno Munro reports.
Young Ok Shin, a South Korean student, was stabbed to death while walking home from a Bournemouth nightclub in 2002. Omar Benghit was convicted of her murder, but there was no CCTV or forensic evidence linking him to the crime, and the only eyewitness had a history of making false allegations. Police had also seen CCTV footage that contradicted her account. They built a case around her anyway and supported her story with circumstantial evidence from other witnesses. Dorset Police said the case had already been dismissed twice by the Court of Appeal and its thoughts were with the victim's family and friends.
The final set of hearings at the UK COVID-19 public inquiry begins today. It will look at the impact of the pandemic on society with a focus on mental health, key workers, the most vulnerable and those who were bereaved. The hearings are set to last 3 weeks. The Communication Workers Union says it's not confident that the Royal Mail letters service will improve in the future. More than 20 postal workers across the UK have told BBC Your Voice that their sorting offices are struggling after hundreds of people express frustration about delayed letters. Royal Mail says the vast majority of post is delivered as planned. Our correspondent Coletta Smith reports.
Postal staff have told us about letters piling up in delivery offices and parcels taking priority. The issues they described include a shortage of staff and vans and an overtime restriction. Craig Anderson from the CWU said he thought Royal Mail was a company in crisis. In response, Royal Mail said adverse weather alongside higher than usual sickness had caused some short-term disruption to certain routes. It said it was working to resolve problems as quickly as possible. It added that parcels had to be taken out quickly to avoid physical safety issues in depots.
Coletta Smith reporting.
Thank you, Chris. It's 6:07. Let's see what the weather has in store for us today with Elizabeth Rizzini. Morning.
Hello there. Good morning, Anna. Well, it's quite an unsettled start to the new week. It's going to feel a bit colder again. There'll be some wintriness, I think, over the tops of the hills through the middle part of the week. Some issues with frost and ice as well. And then it's all turning a lot milder, more unsettled as we head towards the end of the week. And it could feel quite spring-like at times. There will be some sunshine around. But for today, it's a day of blustery showers with some sunny spells. Largely frost-free this morning, but there is a Met Office ice warning placed for eastern Scotland and the far northeast of England. So it's colder here. Watch out for those icy stretches. There'll be quite frequent blustery showers, I think, across parts of northwest England. For northern Scotland, more organised band of showers. There'll be wintry over 200 metres and the snow levels are set to drop throughout the day too. Northern Ireland, it's a cloudy start. There'll be some showers, but it should turn a bit sunnier later. And for the rest of England and Wales, those showers will continue to track southwards and eastwards. They'll form in bands. They will reach East Anglia and the southeast of England, but there'll be some sunshine in between the showers and it could turn a bit wintry over the higher ground of the Pennines, the Fells, the Welsh Mountains. Brisk northwesterly winds and top temperatures of around 6 to 9 degrees Celsius in the north, but 8 to 11 degrees Celsius towards the south. And tonight, watch out for a colder feeling night with temperatures hovering round about freezing.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. It's now 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Times says the Prime Minister is seeking to steady his premiership by using what are called Henry VIII powers to force through fast changes to online safety, including, the paper says, the possible banning of under-16s from social media. This year, the Times says pressure is growing internally after more than 60 Labour MPs called for the move last month. Opposition parties have accused the Prime Minister of using delaying tactics by starting a consultation when they say a ban could be introduced now.
The Daily Mail this morning leads on Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and what it says are mounting calls for a full police investigation into his role as a UK trade envoy. The Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, tells the paper the former prince abused his position by allegedly sending sensitive information to Jeffrey Epstein and that there must be a public inquiry. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has always denied wrongdoing.
The Telegraph reports that a man who set fire to a Koran in London may be accepted by the United States as a refugee from Britain if he loses his blasphemy case this week. The paper says the Crown Prosecution Service will contest the decision to overturn Hamit Koskun's conviction for a religiously aggravated public order offence at a High Court hearing tomorrow. Officials in Washington says it's one of several cases being considered.
A lead story for The Guardian is research that's found the number of women driven to suicide by domestic abusers is underreported and police are overlooking cases where it happens. It cites a study from a suicide prevention programme in Kent which suggests the number of suicides with domestic abuse at their core could be 10 times higher than figures from the National Police Chiefs Council. Experts are quoted calling it a national scandal.
And The Express using its front page to launch a campaign calling for streetlights to be kept on at night to protect women and girls and to prevent road accidents. The government tells the paper it's working with local authorities to increase lighting in key spaces.
It's 11 minutes past six. The BBC's learned that the Prime Minister is considering a significant increase in defence spending. James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent, is in Munich. James, morning. What have you learned?
Good morning. Well, look, last year, the government set out its strategic defence review, big reforms about how it wanted to change the way it defends the United Kingdom. But since then, it's been talking to itself and failing to decide how it's going to spend, raise the money to actually meet all of those new commitments. And in the process, they've realised that existing costs are rising fast, as well as trying to meet, you know, the challenges from the future threat from Russia. So there is a debate going on about whether they need to increase the defence spending faster. At the moment, they're committed to increasing defence spending so that they spend 2.5% of national wealth, GDP, by April 27. And then there's an ambition to rise, to increase that to 3% of GDP in the next parliament. What I've been told is that there are some in Downing Street now who are arguing for that 3% ambition to be moved left on the timeline. In other words, met not in the next parliament, but this. And the consequences for that, if they were to make that decision, would be huge, because you're talking having to find an extra 13, 14, according to the IFS, billion pounds extra each year. And that would have huge, huge consequences for the public purse.
Yeah, as you say, it's a huge amount of money. Is there any suggestion, James, of where that could come from or how that could be found?
No, they're not there yet. I mean, the Prime Minister said at the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, look, you know, to meet the wider threat, and this is a quote, it's clear we're going to have to spend more faster, and made a sustained argument for increasing defence spending. But somebody said to me, the problem is it felt like a speech with an argument without an actual announcement. And I think that the problem is finding that money, you know, it would be very, very difficult at a time when we already know the government is struggling, you know, with the fiscal rules and the cost of living crisis, because, you know, the Treasury is naturally reluctant to increase borrowing. And then other than that, you're just going to have to cut something elsewhere. And at the moment, yes, there are lots of obvious targets, but at the moment, there's been no agreement at all. First of all, that this is what they should do, let alone where they should find the money. So at the moment, number 10 saying no decisions taken. This is speculation. The MOD insisting again they're not going to comment on what they call speculation.
That's interesting. James, thank you. James Landale, our diplomatic correspondent in Munich.
It's coming up to 14 minutes past six. A key figure in Ukraine's corruption scandal, the former energy minister, has been arrested while trying to leave the country. Paul Adams, our diplomatic correspondent, is in Kyiv and can tell us more. What's going on, Paul?
Yeah, Nick, this is Herman Halushenko, who was at one point the country's energy minister, and he's one of several figures implicated in an elaborate $100 million embezzlement scheme involving kickbacks in the nuclear industry. The scheme is alleged to have begun a year before Russia's full-scale invasion. And I think there was a real source of anger even before the winter set in, that someone so important to, you know, keeping the country heated and lit was involved in such a scandal. So he was detained yesterday while apparently attempting to leave the country. He was detained on board a train. We don't yet know exactly where he was planning to go. He doesn't yet he hasn't yet faced charges, but it's thought that he's being brought back to Kyiv as the investigation continues. And, you know, as the country becomes even more dependent on the power generated by 9 nuclear reactors in 3 sites around the country, I think this scandal has rarely seemed more pertinent than it does right now. As I look out of the window, there's heavy snow once again overnight, and temperatures set to plummet again this week.
And it matters too, Paul, doesn't it? Because the United States, Donald Trump in particular, have been putting a lot of pressure on Kyiv to have elections, despite the fact they always say they can't because of martial law.
Yes, this whole elections and referendum proposal just won't go away. This is something that President Zelensky has indicated he might be willing to do sometime in the spring. In fact, speaking at the Munich Security Conference, he said if the Americans want to push this, then he might be prepared to consider it, provided there was a ceasefire and conditions were in place. I think this is the kind of thing that Ukraine's European allies fear, that the president, under, as you say, enormous pressure to make concessions purely to satisfy an American president who's in a hurry to get all this done before the US midterms, might be prepared to accept an idea that many of them see as a cynical trap, as a Russian idea designed to try and replace the legitimate government of Ukraine and put in something a bit more pliable.
Paul Adams in Kyiv, thank you.
16 minutes past six, weeks of heavy rain have taken their toll on most of us. But for farmers, it's been particularly problematic. Across parts of the UK, they're dealing now with flooded fields and damaged crops. With more on that and the rest of the day's business news, here's Leanna Byrne. Morning.
Thanks. Good morning, Anna. The misery, it's also being faced by dairy farmers who are already seeing milk prices fall again as global supply continues to push prices lower. We're joined now by Tom Bradshaw, president of the National Farmers Union. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
Can you just spell out to us how serious is this flooding?
I mean, we've seen weeks of extreme rainfall since the start of this year. We've got many farmers, particularly in the southwest and Somerset and the levels there, that are facing very severe flooding, crops that have been underwater for several weeks and unfortunately will now begin to die because they just simply can't cope being underwater for any longer. And so it's been a really, really challenging start to the year. I mean, you have to remember that things like parsnips and carrots and cabbages are harvested right the way through the winter. So for those farmers as well, it's been difficult making sure they can keep the supply going into retailers, which is obviously critically important.
Yeah. I'm wondering, is this short-term disruption or is that lasting damage to the year's harvest?
Well, there will be some where the crops have been lost, where there is lasting damage and there will be real financial pain felt. I mean, the critical window now is through the next 6 weeks when a lot of the spring corn would be planted. So there's a lot of crops to be put into the ground. There's fertilizer to be applied to the crops that were planted last autumn. And making sure that, well, the ground conditions come right to travel and to get those crops planted is absolutely essential. Otherwise, the knock-on impact continues for a much, much longer period of time. So the weather over the next few weeks is pretty critical now.
March is a critical time, isn't it? So what does that mean for food supply and prices later this year, just for the consumers?
Look, at the moment, because we live on a global market and there is an oversupply of grain around the world, unfortunately, a lot of farmers are receiving below the cost of production for the wheat and barley and oats that we produced last year. So they're really struggling to make a living anyway. And this wet weather just compounds that. And I think the concern looking forwards is that if March turns into a wet month, then those farmers, our members, are going to be really struggling looking forwards as to how they're going to continue producing the grain crops that they do. When that spreads into other sectors. Actually, the cheaper grain is helpful for the poultry and the pig sectors. And you mentioned dairy there. And obviously, we've seen a collapse in the dairy markets from September last year through to this point in time. There's been an over, we've lost over 10 pence a litre from what it, what the dairy farmer is receiving. And yet at the retail shelf, you won't have seen any change.
Last year, record milk volumes we saw, it really overwhelmed processors and some milk was tipped away. Now, production is still high. Is there a real risk that happens again this spring?
Like you say, globally, we've seen overproduction. At the end of last year, I think we saw 7% more milk produced in the UK in the last 6 months of last year than the previous year. So it was just brilliant conditions that were producing that milk. As we move forward, the spring flush is the period sort of through April and May when the cows get turned out onto fresh grass. That's a time where production normally peaks. And so much is going to be dependent on what the weather is, how much feed value there is in that grass, and how much of it is wasted, depending on how wet the fields are. But if we see, you know, really good production this spring, there's a real concern that we may not have the processing capacity to deal with all of the milk which is being produced. And the worst thing for a dairy farmer, you can imagine all of their work seeing it go down the drain if there's no one coming to collect that milk because there isn't the processing capacity. It really is incredibly difficult if you're that farmer that has to open the tap and let it run away.
Can the government step in and help farmers here? For example, investment in flood infrastructure, has it kept pace?
No, you're absolutely right there. We need to view our river network as part of our critical national infrastructure. Protecting our, you know, our land from flooding is absolutely essential as we look to build the resilience of the food system for the future. Over the last 30 years, we've spent less and less on river maintenance. Now, in our uplands and in our hills, you can slow the flow of water. But in our lowlands, we need those rivers to function to get that water out to sea as quickly as possible. And that does mean we need to focus on the management of those watercourses and make sure that we are investing with an eye on the future rather than just the here and now. And when we see these floods, the impact on wildlife is quite incredible. I remember going to Lincolnshire 2 years ago and you saw water voles, you saw hares that unfortunately hadn't been able to survive the flooding. So it's the farmer's income, but it's also the long-term impact on wildlife from not maintaining these assets.
Okay, Tom Bradshaw, President of the National Farmers Union, thank you so much for joining us. Now, speaking of bad weather, Japanese data rained on the Nikkei's parade as the GDP badly missed forecasts. With me now is Zoe Gillespie, investment manager for RBC Brewin Dolphin. Zoe, what were analysts expecting from Japan?
Yeah, I think certainly they were expecting better than the 0.2% annual piece in the last quarter. And certainly, I think what we've seen is private consumption rose by 0.4% on an annualised basis, but it was the exports that brought it down with a drop in 1.1%. So we're seeing that the economy expanded just over 1% last year, which is the fastest pace since 2022, but certainly was lower than anticipated.
Now, the Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, wants to stimulate the economy by increasing government spending. So do you think she has more of a case for it now?
Yeah, I mean, I think now that we've seen this, then we're probably going to, that was one of her policies, was to help revive the economy by spending more. So I think certainly this will come as welcome news given the current data coming in.
Now, this one made the front page of the FT this morning. Uber saying its plans to expand its delivery arm into 7 new European countries. And delivery, it's been a tough margin business historically. Is this growth profitable, do you think?
Yeah, certainly. Uber Eats is now accounts for about a third of the revenue from the business. And the expansion comes after last week's announcement that they have bought Turkish delivery company Getir to expand its Turkish footprint. And certainly the Uber delivery business saw a 30% increase in revenue in the fourth quarter of 2025, with Asia, Europe and the Middle East being the fastest growing region. So I think this actually fits with the trend, and they are seeing that this is a business area that has been lucrative for them.
Now, do you think Europe is attractive right now because of weaker competition or possibly because US growth is slowing?
Probably a bit of both. And I think certainly if it's able to expand there, and as you say, Europe has been one of its fastest growing areas, It obviously sees investment in this area is something that could potentially lead to greater growth for them.
All right, Zoe Gillespie, Investment Manager for RBC Brewin Dauphin, thank you so much. Now, artificial intelligence is spooking another industry. This time, it's wealth management. Shares in firms including St. James's Place, AJ Bell, Quilter and Rathbones fell sharply after a US fintech company launched an AI tool that says it can read documents like payslips and account statements and generate personalised tax strategies in minutes. Investors fear that if AI can automate parts of financial advice, it could eat into the fees these firms charge. Matt Wilshire is Managing Director of Niche Private Clients. Matt, good morning.
Morning.
Now, this new product says it can read financial documents and generate tax strategies in minutes. What exactly can it do that advisors currently charge for?
Oh, I think we're into a sort of a scenario whereby it can handle the technical pieces that we do. So that is the picking of the investments, the rebalancing of portfolios, calculation of tax, you know, and it can do it for £100 a month. You know, the product that came out from Altruist this week is quite impressive. And it is really looking at a scenario where if advisors charge currently £2,000 to £3,000 for that part of there, they're in real trouble.
Are you worried?
I don't think we can be worried. I think there's an opportunity here. I think it's the idea that really what we're paid for should be around the coordination of family wealth. It's this idea of if you are in a position where you can navigate disagreements, navigate the sort of the empathy, the emotions around financial planning and things like that, actually there's a real opportunity in this. But ultimately, it's the old model where you charge for investment management and the sort of just rebalancing once a year is probably, in trouble.
Yeah, but if AI can automate tax planning, paperwork, isn't that directly attacking one of those billable parts of wealth management?
Well, I think, again, it depends on the smaller firms. You can see these days actually are very much in the mentality that you outsource those pieces and already, you know, you outsource the investment management part of the business, you outsource those other pieces, and actually the real value comes in those human empathy part of the business, that management piece. So I do think it's the case of rather than look at this as something to fear, but look at something that we can develop on and actually wrap this around the human element of what we do.
But even if you do outsource this, you're still making a margin, right? So if the technology spreads, will clients actually pay less for that advice because they know a human's not doing it?
No, well, I think exactly the point. I think that it should be driving the price of this down. Actually, I think the days where we're paying £1,000, £2,000 for that part of the element, should come down, because ultimately, you know, we're talking about the things that are out of our control as financial advisors.
Now, this is a regulated sector, of course. If an AI system suggests a technically correct strategy that doesn't reflect what a client actually wants, who's accountable?
Well, exactly. I think there's the real key, is that fundamentally at this moment in time, it's going to still fall to those regulated elements. So it's going to have to still be the idea that this can do some of the technical thinking for us, but fundamentally, marrying it up with the suitability and the key components of the suitability, let's say, will still fall on the humans and those institutions as such. So we are still always going to carry the risk with this in the short term. But again, it comes back to this idea that we need to put ourselves as those people that can really look into the eyes of a client and let's say talk them off a ledge when the markets are in trouble, for example. So it's all got to come back to this idea that can we use these services to the best of our ability.
So who do you think the winner is here, the AI or guys like you?
Oh, I think undoubtedly it's going to be the financial advisors that can use and adapt these pieces of software to actually help us do our job and make us more efficient and actually, you know, widen the market for, you know, as we stand today, there's 9% of the industry, you know, 9% of the UK will take financial advice, and that, you know, we need to be looking at, can we be providing advice to that 91% that it doesn't currently take financial advice.
All right, Matt Wilshire, Managing Director of Niche Private Clients, thank you so much for joining us.
Eliana, thank you very much indeed. A great joy of sport. What else is happening in the news? It can cheer you up, Garthy.
Oh, it was such a good day. A historic day at the Winter Olympics. The first time that Great Britain has won 2 gold medals in a single day. And Matt Weston, Tabby Stoker became mixed team skeleton Olympic champions.
I think I'm in shock.
Luckily, I felt like I kind of knew what I needed to do. I had the individual event. I kind of took a load of confidence from that, and I just had to almost in my head be boring, get the job done, and yeah, we've done it again.
You're so good.
There was a first ever gold on snow too. Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale won the snowboard cross mixed team event.
Shifting into gold medal position, she airs up and over. She's got the board speed. Charlotte Banks on that last turn.
She's going to
hold him off.
She's going to do it for Great Britain.
Moya Willey's there, but it's too far and it's too late.
It's gold!
A gold medal for Great Britain.
It now means Team GB has won three gold medals at a Winter Olympics for the first time. That's after Matt Weston also won individual gold in the skeleton on Friday. We'll hear from him and Tabby Stoker in the next hour. Arsenal reached the FA Cup fifth round with a 4-0 win over Wigan. Wolves edged past Grimsby Town with a 1-0 victory. And League One side Mansfield Town came from behind to beat Premier League strugglers Burnley 2-1 to reach the fifth round for the first time since 1975. All of the FA Cup results are on the BBC Sport website. While Hearts lead at the top of the Scottish Premiership is down to 2 points now after they lost 4-2 to second place Rangers, and Manchester City remain 8 points clear at the top of the Women's Super League. The Wales Rugby Union head coach Steve Tandy has called for unity after a 23rd defeat in 25 tests. Wales lost to France 54 points to 12 in the Six Nations, and there were more than 15,000 empty seats at the Principality Stadium.
I think they do understand what part of the journey we're on. But the only thing I can say is, like, we are, like, the boys, you see the effort out there today. I know the scoreboard doesn't reflect that, but the effort the boys put in, there's a young group there that actually, like, they love the support, they love the connection to our community and our nation. And ultimately, the more we get people in the stadium, the better. It does make a massive help for us.
Scotland had a brilliant 31 points to 20 win over England, and Ireland beat Italy in the Six Nations at the weekend. India thrashed Pakistan in cricket, beating them by 61 runs in their highly anticipated T20 World Cup match. That match only went ahead after the Pakistan government lifted a request for their team to boycott the game over security fears. England face Italy this morning at 9:30. There's commentary on Sports Extra and a little bit of golf news to finish. England's Charlie Hull won the PIF Saudi Ladies International by one shot to claim her fifth Ladies European Tour title.
Thank you, Kathy.
Before the anthems, before worldwide fame, before becoming a frontman, he was a drummer.
Really had no ambition to be a singer. I really didn't want to come out from behind the drums.
It's Eras, Phil Collins.
I'm Zoe Ball, and this is a story about an accidental icon.
If that divorce thing had never happened, I would never have started singing and writing in the way that I did, which means that Phil Collins' solo guy would never have happened.
It's the latest series of the Radio 2 podcast, Eras. Listen now on BBC Sounds. Just search Phil Collins.
Time now is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. And Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
The government says it will move more quickly to close gaps in laws designed to protect children online. Sir Keir Starmer says no platform will get a free pass on children's safety. The Online Safety Act was drafted before the emergence of AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. Campaigners and bereaved parents have welcomed the announcement. The BBC has learned that the Prime Minister is considering making a significant increase in defence spending. Downing Street is examining whether to bring forward the existing target of 3% of GDP at a potential cost of up to £14 billion a year. BBC News understands that the front-runner to become the government's most senior civil servant was spoken to about her management style following an inquiry into a complaint against her. Dame Antonia Romeo is one of three officials currently sharing the role of Cabinet Secretary on a temporary basis. An investigation into a single complaint made in 2017 concluded there was no case to answer. The Conservatives are urging Labour to suspend its links with the think tank Labour Together after it commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of several journalists. In 2023, the group asked a US lobbying firm to examine the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times story about its donations. Its then leader, Josh Simons, who's now a Cabinet Office Minister, says ACPO strayed beyond its brief. The man accused of murdering 15 people at a Jewish event on Bondi Beach in December has appeared in court in Australia for the first time. Naveed Akran is accused of opening fire on crowds at a Hanukkah celebration, along with his father Sajid, who was killed by police during the attack. The final hearings of the UK COVID-19 public inquiry begin today. Over the next 3 weeks, the inquiry will examine the wider impact of the pandemic on society, including mental health, key workers, the most vulnerable and the bereaved.
Thank you, Chris. It's 27 minutes to seven. A new package of online safety measures is being announced by the government this morning. Mark Chislack is the BBC's AI correspondent, and he told me more about what's in it.
Well, the government's proposing a tightening of rules around a number of online issues, including things like AI chatbots. It says that these measures are necessary primarily to protect children online. I mean, this comes after a row between the UK's government and Elon Musk's X, which occurred earlier this year. It wasn't just the UK. There were governments around the world that got involved in this row. And it was when the social media platform's Grok AI chatbot was used to create fake nude images, primarily of women. Now, AI chatbot providers will be required to follow the same rules around illegal content as other platforms. Now, the government's trying to close a legal loophole so that they have to comply with their duties under the Online Safety Act. There's also plans to introduce flexible legal powers, allowing faster updates to the laws or faster updates to laws without needing entirely new legislation as the technologies evolve. The thing is, some of these moves have already been announced by the government, including a public consultation, which is coming in March. Now, this will consider some measures, some of which are likely to be quite contentious, including setting a minimum age for social media use, which I think is going to be really, really contentious, exploring limits on children's access to AI chatbots, as well as preventing children from using VPNs or virtual private networks. So that's the stuff that we know is coming.
And obviously that's what the government wants to focus on, Mark. But what about the things that aren't yet being covered? Because there are critics who say there are whole swathes here that are just not being looked at.
The government is really trying to future-proof legislation and future-proof laws, but in doing so, it creates quite a bit of flexibility and quite a bit of risk. And that risk is really around anybody arguing against the government's position on any of these issues. I mean, the big questions, though, are, will this approach, what does it actually mean in practice? And is the government giving itself broad new powers in areas where the long-term impacts of the technology are still really, really uncertain?
Mark Chislack, thank you.
It's coming up to 24 minutes to seven now. Calls are mounting for an investigation into the actions of a Labour minister who hired lobbyists to produce a report into the personal, political and religious views of a journalist whose stories he didn't like. Our political correspondent Joe Pike joins us. In essence, Joe, is the allegation here a simple one? Keir Starmer's favourite pressure group spied on a journalist whose reports they didn't like.
It is exactly, Nick. They investigated the Sunday Times journalist Gabriel Pogrand, who was revealing what some see as the deception at the heart of Labour Together, once run by Morgan McSweeney. This is the think tank that a few years ago wanted to take back control of Labour from Jeremy Corbyn and his allies, spent massive amounts of money polling Labour members to understand what they wanted in a leader, then use that information to help get Keir Starmer the top job. What they didn't do is register more than £700,000 worth of donations they'd received on time, and arguably that hid the real nature and intentions of their group, although they've always said that was an admin error. So after journalists at the Sunday Times, including Gabriel Pogrand, wrote about the think tank and its funding, this is in 2023, Labour Together's CEO, Josh Simons, now a government minister, spent more than £30,000 getting a lobbying company to investigate those journalists and their sources. The company is called APCO Worldwide. We now know there was information in APCO's report about Mr. Pogrand's personal life, relationships and religious beliefs. There seem to have been smears and inaccuracies too. And a complicating factor, Nick, is that the person at APCO who wrote that report, Tom Harper, is a former Sunday Times journalist. He's not responded to requests for comment.
We're going to hear from the editor of the Sunday Times later in the programme. This is just yet another problem in Keir Starmer's overflowing intro, isn't it?
It is, and another problem, Nick, where ethics and judgment are at the heart of the story. All of this has been widely condemned, including by some Labour MPs, and the Conservatives, who have been pretty effective in piling pressure on the government regarding Peter Mandelson and Matthew Doyle. They now want an investigation and for Keir Starmer to cut ties with this group. group. The response from Josh Simons, then the CEO, now the minister, as we heard in the news bulletin, is basically, yes, I commissioned this investigation, but it went beyond the remit I'd asked for. Labour Together have a new boss now who's trying to distance herself and her organisation from all of this. Meanwhile, APCO Worldwide say on their website they offer, quote, innovative solutions to manage and overcome crises. Well, this, Nick, is clearly a crisis. Their innovative solution so far is silence. No response to our request for comment. But the trade body that they are a member of, the PRCA, is now investigating them.
Well, arguably, Joe, it was innovative, but perhaps not in a way it was meant to be. Joe Pike, our political correspondent there.
It's 22 minutes to seven.
The final hearings of the UK COVID-19 inquiry begin today. Hugh Pym is the BBC's health editor. Morning to you. Hugh, what are they looking at in this final module?
Well, Nick, yes, the final set of hearings after the inquiry began back in 2023 will look at the impact on society, on the vulnerable, the bereaved, key workers and aspects of mental health. And what the inquiry officials are saying is that if you look at all the previous nine modules, they all in some way involve government decisions and the impact on the population. This is the module that looks purely at society, individuals within society and how they were impacted and perhaps some of the positive aspects of life during the pandemic because of different organisations in society and how they helped people. Now, the hearings will come to the end on March the 5th. Then we've got a series of reports because what Baroness Hallett, the inquiry chair, has been doing is writing reports on each module more or less as we go along. So we've heard, for example, the first one on the impact of decisions before the pandemic, then of course all the government actions under Boris Johnson's administration with Matt Hancock and others giving evidence. And those will now continue. And the last one, the final report on Module 10, will be in the first half of 2027. That's when the inquiry finally comes to an end.
So 7 years after COVID struck and at a vast cost, Hugh.
Yes, the inquiry have acknowledged it's cost £200 million and there are extra costs in government, tens of millions of pounds more, preparing evidence to submit to the inquiry. But what the inquiry secretary, Ben Connor, says is that this is the broadest of any UK public inquiry, looking at events that affected maybe in some ways the whole population. And if you look at the total cost to the economy of COVID, hundreds of billions of pounds, nearly 400 billion on one estimate. And their view is that this is what it has taken to cover such a broad swathe. And they've had the biggest public engagement, they say, of any public inquiry. 60,000 people have submitted, either online or with oral evidence, their views of what happened. So that is their justification for this inquiry as it continues with these hearings to end in a few weeks' time and then another year or so of final reporting on conclusions. And the UK COVID bereaved Families for Justice group say this is a really important moment that we've got to these final hearings, but they will continue campaigning for lessons to be learned after the hearings come to an end.
Hugh Pym, our health editor, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to seven. Has your Royal Mail post been late in recent weeks? Well, you're not the only one. Coletta Smith is the BBC's Your Voice correspondent. Morning, Coletta.
Morning, Anna. There yeah, are always... we've been contacted by...
Yeah, no, tell me what...
Just don't...
Go ahead.
We've been contacted by hundreds of people from right across the BBC, viewers, listeners, huge frustrations that their post was missing, was late. And of course, that's not just irritating for people. It can be massively important if you've got a missed hospital appointment, a missed doctor's appointment, if you're waiting for test results, or so much banking, of course, is done through the post still. If you're being sent a bank card and that's going missing or not turning up for a long time, it's huge frustration for customers. But the interesting thing at Your Voice is that we were also contacted by existing postal workers. So we were contacted by three current postal staff who wanted to tell us what was happening behind the scenes and actually explain what's going on behind the doors of those delivery offices. And what we heard, we then double-checked. So we got in touch with more than 20 postal staff anonymously right the way across the UK to see if this is a picture that's happening everywhere. And it seems to be the case that lots and lots of postal workers were telling us, yes, what's happening is what was happening over Christmas, that parcels are still being prioritised over first and second class mail, that actually that first and second class mail is building up, that there is huge staff shortages, that overtime has now been completely restricted from the middle of January, so they're not able to clear backlogs that are existing within those delivery offices, and that quite simply they are not able to cope with the amount of mail when they're also dealing with such huge volumes of parcels, such few staff, and indeed not enough vans in a lot of delivery offices, we were being told.
And what has Royal Mail had to say about all of that?
Well, of course, they're saying actually what's going on behind the scenes is temporary. Royal Mail say that they aim to deliver both letters and parcels on time, but that parcels are making up a much bigger proportion of their deliveries and take up more space than letters. They say that adverse weather, including storms Goretti, Ingrid, Chandra in January, alongside higher than usual sick absences, has caused some short-term disruption to certain routes. They say where a delay affects a route, they work to resolve it as quickly as possible by putting in extra support and reviewing performances daily to restore deliveries. But the picture that the existing postal workers have been telling me is a very different one to that. Royal Mail has already been fined by the regulator in the autumn of last year, and it may well be that they are fined again if they are not able to keep up with those first and second class deliveries. And certainly from the customers we've been hearing from, and indeed your listeners, I'm sure many will empathise with this, that actually they're simply not hitting enough of those targets, and people are waiting by the letterbox for days for that post to arrive.
Coletta Smith, thank you.
It is now 16 minutes to seven. New evidence in the case of a man who has spent 23 years in prison for murder suggests he was framed by police, BBC Panorama has found. 13 witnesses have now told the BBC they were pressured to embellish their statements or even to lie at the trial of Omar Benguet. Dorset Police didn't directly address the suggestion that officers had framed him, but said its investigation was, and I quote, thorough, detailed and very complex. The woman who has been following this, indeed doing the digging, is Panorama's reporter Bronna Munro, and she joins me now. Morning to you, Bronna. Remind us of the details of this murder.
Good morning, Nick. Yes, there was a South Korean student, Yong Ok Shin, known as Oki. She was walking home after a night out in Bournemouth when she was stabbed in the back with a 6-inch blade. Now, with her dying words, she told police and medical staff that she'd been attacked by a man wearing a mask who ran off. Dorset police were under pressure to solve this crime because Bournemouth's economy relies on international students, and the South Korean government wanted this killer caught. Now, the police charged Omar Benguet, an addict with a history of drug and knife crime. Now, when it went to court, two juries couldn't reach a verdict, but Benguet was convicted of murder at a third trial, even though there was no CCTV, no DNA and no forensics connecting him to this crime.
So what is the evidence that suggests he may have been framed?
6 weeks after the murder, a witness came forward to police. Now, this witness was a drug addict with a history of making false allegations. We're going to call her BB for legal reasons. Now, she accused two men of the murder before naming Omar Benguet. We've also discovered the police had seen CCTV footage that contradicted her account, but they built a case around her evidence anyway. And they did that by gathering circumstantial evidence from other witnesses. Most of those witnesses were drug addicts. Over the years, as you said, 13 of those witnesses have come forward and spoke to me. They said they were pressured by the police to give false evidence. Leanne was 17 at the time. She says officers put her in the back of a car and made her sign a statement that they'd written.
I was so scared, I didn't even read the statement. Like, I just signed it and wanted to get out of that car.
Did the police know that you were telling lies?
Yeah, of course they did. This statement was their words, 95% of it.
Some people might be looking at this interview and thinking, well, if Leanne told lies back then, could she be telling lies now in this interview? What would you say to that?
I've got nothing to gain from this, apart from right and wrong. I don't...
It's powerful evidence. Now, there is a body that's meant to investigate these things. What's happening with that?
Well, the Criminal Cases Review Commission launched an investigation after my last programme about Omar Benguet. That was 5 years ago. And the CCRC is still looking at the case. We also showed our evidence to a retired detective, former DCI Brian Murphy. He used to run murder teams, murder review teams. He told me the case cries out for a review by the Independent Office for Police Conduct.
People have gone into court and told lies. That's astonishing. If I found police officers who were altering evidence or coaching witnesses, I would want that investigated in its own right. Nothing to do with the murder inquiry, in its own right.
What about the man at the centre of all this you've been talking to, Omar Benguet, in prison? What's he had to say?
Well, Omar Benguet's maintained his innocence since the day he was convicted, if not the day he was arrested. He's now served 23 years, and that means he would be eligible for release if he said he was guilty. So I asked him about that. Omar, if you admitted that you did this, right, you would have probably gotten out by now. You wouldn't have had to stay inside.
No, I'd have been out 4 years ago. I'd rather die in prison saying I didn't do it than get released now saying I did do it. It's not going to happen. I'm an innocent man.
Now, Dorset Police told us that Omar Benguet had appealed twice against his conviction and that both cases had been dismissed by the Court of Appeal. A spokesperson added that it would instigate investigations if directed by the courts and responsible authorities. Dorset Police also said that their thoughts were with Oki's family and friends who remain devastated by her loss.
Bronagh Munro, thank you very much indeed. That story on Panorama, Framed for Murder, you can watch it on iPlayer now or tonight on BBC One at 8 o'clock.
It's 11 minutes to 7. At least 34 children have been infected by a fast-spreading measles outbreak at schools in North London. The UK actually lost its measles elimination status in January of this year after outbreaks in 2024. Dr. Joe Savage is a GP in Enfield, Chief Medical Officer of the local NHS Integrated Care Board, which works with the council to try and manage this. Dr. Savage, good morning.
Good morning.
Just give us a bit of context here, an idea of how serious this particular outbreak is.
Yes, thank you very much. So, as you said, we've seen about 60 suspected cases confirmed now in this particular outbreak, which is centred in Enfield. The majority of cases have been children, schools, nurseries in particular, and some children have required hospitalisation, particularly those who were not fully immunised. And so this really does show the consequences can be serious. So we've really been working very closely to contain the infection, the spread, but also increase public knowledge and awareness. We are worried because actually this is a significantly increased number to what we're used to. We do see these increasing numbers that happen in pockets across the country, but certainly in our area, we've not seen an increase in number of this degree before.
And you talked about vaccination. Is that what is behind this? Just not enough children being vaccinated against measles?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. The local MMR rate are about 65%, and that's broadly in line with the rest of London. But we know that London is the lowest region in the country by some margin. London is seeing the fastest rate of decline in terms of vaccination rates, so it's something that is really concerning. And we know that historical data has shown that really high rates of vaccination do protect. And so the fact that the number of vaccinations is coming down is a significant cause for concern. And that has been something that's happened over the last 10 years.
And how do you deal with that? Because there are often various different reasons why people don't choose to get their children vaccinated.
Yes, there are many reasons. And I suppose the important point there is that no one intervention will sort the problem. I mean, I think it's a combination of we have a mobile population, and so therefore that can disrupt the routine vaccination program. I think since the pandemic, there's been a real impact on childhood immunizations across the board. And some families face particular barriers like getting appointments, or simply they don't know that their child is not fully vaccinated, or they have some concerns. So I suppose the intervention has to tackle all of those things. So make sure we improve access to appointments, make sure that people are aware how to get hold of those appointments, vaccinate outside the normal places. So go out into schools and community centres so that there's reducing barriers to getting vaccines. And then finally, the most important thing is really speaking one-on-one to individuals about their concerns, helping people understand what measles is, how serious it can be, but also dispel any concerns that they have about side effects or problems with the vaccine, which is safe.
Yeah. Dr. Joe Sauvage, thanks for joining us.
It's now 7:07. Russia murdered the leading dissident, Alexei Navalny, using poison taken from Ecuadorian dart frogs. That was the claim made yesterday by the Foreign Secretary on behalf of Britain, Sweden, France, Germany and the Netherlands. What should happen now? We're joined by Hamish de Breton Gordon, former commander of British and NATO chemical and nuclear force with many, many years' experience in this field. Morning to you, Hamish. Can I start with a puzzle to start with? It's being called a chemical attack, whereas you might be forgiven for thinking if it's come from a frog, it'd be biological. Talk us through the thinking there, if you would.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Nick. It's actually designated a toxic chemical because it is a chemical in effect. This is a toxin that's been extracted from the frog and then used as a murder weapon, as you say, against Alexei Navalny. So it's a technicality, but it comes under the Chemical Weapons Convention. Russia signed it to, in effect, outlaw chemical weapons across the world. But unfortunately, this is classic modus operandi. The Russian Secret Service, Alexei Litvinenko, was murdered with polonium-210. Sergei Skripal attempted murder with another chemical weapon, Novichok, in Salisbury, where I'm talking to you from, and now Alexei Navalny. But it is a war crime and it is illegal.
We're going to be talking to Litvinenko's widow a little later in the programme. Would the Russians have known that we would know what they'd done? And indeed, do they want the world to know what they're capable of?
Well, that is really the most important question. I think, first of all, those of us who look at these things closely are not surprised at all that Navalny was murdered by the Russian state. We are rather surprised that actually we have samples that have been analysed that prove the Russian state do it. There was certainly a view when Sergei Skripal was attempted to be murdered with Novichok that the Russian state wanted the West to know that it had the ability to take anybody out who opposed them, and also, in a way, had the ability to develop these most terrible chemical weapons. So it might well be the case. But I think it also shows how inept, actually, the Russian Secret Service are, that we actually have these samples. So in normal times, you'd thought it'd be a real embarrassment to Putin, but I doubt it. But I think it does show to NATO that we need to be prepared. Our forces need to be prepared to fight in a contaminated environment. Because the other thing that's going on at the moment is the Russians are using chemical weapons on an industrial scale on the front line, and they have been doing for the last couple of years.
So we need to be prepared. There is a call from the ministers of the various countries I listed that there should be an investigation now by the Organisation for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons. I can't imagine it's likely to get very far, is it?
Well, unfortunately, it's probably not, Nick. The way that the Chemical Weapons Convention goes, that if there is a reported chemical attack in a country, that country must request the Organisation for Prohibition of Chemical Weapons to come and investigate. And nobody's expecting the Russians to invite the OPCW into Russia, into the Arctic, to investigate it. So I think it's highly unlikely. However, we do have these samples from Navalny that have been analysed, we understand, in the UK and Sweden and elsewhere in laboratories that are designated as OPCD laboratories. So in theory, we have the evidence that could be presented to the International Criminal Court, and another war crime for President Putin to answer, hopefully in the future at some time.
Which so far, spokespeople for the Kremlin describe this as necropropaganda and the feeble-mindedness of Western fabulists.
Yes, well, as we get virtually on a daily basis from the propaganda machine coming out of the Kremlin, we would expect no less. So I think people should take that with a pinch of salt, the fact that these NATO countries led by the UK have demonstrated that they have the evidence that Navalny was murdered by the state. That is what people should believe.
Hamish.
And whether there are sanctions or not, we should move forward.
Hamish de Bretton Gordon, thank you for joining us.
Let's hear about a new investigative series starting this morning.
Could the chemicals in everyday products be causing us some serious harm?
One portion of fish was giving somebody a higher dose of PFAS than if they had drank contaminated water for a month.
I'm Mark Miodovnik. I'll be exploring the chemicals that are accumulating in almost everyone's bodies, from microplastics in bottled water to PFAS, the forever chemicals in our cosmetics.
We are going to continue to be exposed to them for centuries because they don't break down.
What are these chemicals doing to us? I'll be testing my kitchen, my bathroom, my producer's cat, and even my own blood to find out. Toxic begins this morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time for the weather now. Here's Elizabeth.
Thank you, Nick. Well, it's certainly an unsettled start to the week. There's a lot more rain to come, blustery showers today, but there should be some sunny spells in between. So it's a mostly frost-free start to the morning. There is an ice warning, though, issued by the Met Office valid until 10 o'clock for parts of northeast England and eastern Scotland, too, across northern Scotland. Then, again, it's quite a sharp frost here this morning, and there's some wintriness over the hills. There will be some fairly frequent blustery showers across northwest England, just blowing down on that northwesterly wind. The showers likely to band together, so they'll be fairly organised. There'll be some bright, some sunny spells in between them. The snow levels will actually be dropping across parts of Scotland as we head throughout the day, so turning increasingly more wintry to lower levels. For Northern Ireland, it's a cloudy start. There'll be some showers. It will brighten up a bit later on. For the rest of England and Wales, those showers will track further southwards and eastwards. They'll reach parts of southeast England, East Anglia at times, but there will be some brighter skies in between. Bit of wintriness over the higher ground of the Pennines and the Fells, brisk northwesterlies, 6 to 11 degrees Celsius and milder in eastern England than yesterday.
Thanks, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 16th of February. The headlines this morning. The government is pledging to respond more quickly to protect children from online harms, warning tech giants they won't get a free pass. In a constantly shifting online world, will it work? The technology secretary will join us in around an hour. The BBC has learnt that the Prime Minister is considering a significant boost in defence spending, and evidence seen by Panorama suggests a man who spent 23 years in prison for a murder in Bournemouth was framed by the police.
Also to come in the next hour of the programme, we are packed full of Olympic joy this morning. Thanks to Team GB, we're taking you right to the heart of the Milano Cortina Winter Games and Britain's first ever gold on snow, thanks to Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale in the snowboard cross.
A gold medal for Great Britain in the mixed team snowboard cross, and after heartbreak 3 days ago.
Could there be more to come? GB Snow Sports boss joins Carthy in the next half hour. And it was sporting history for skeleton racers Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker too. He has become the first GB athlete to take home two gold medals in a single Winter Olympics.
2 minutes to go. Matt Weston for Great Britain. It's gold again. It's gold once more. Unbelievable. This is indeed a Super Sunday. Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker have won a gold medal.
And fresh from the ice, they'll be sliding on to today at 10 to 8 this morning. Before all of that, the BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The government is pledging to respond more quickly to close loopholes in laws designed to protect children online. Sir Keir Starmer says technology is moving really fast and no online platform will get a free pass. Campaigners and bereaved parents have welcomed the news, but opposition parties say ministers are not moving quickly enough to ban under-16s from social media, describing a consultation due to begin next month as inaction. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
The Online Safety Act was written before the release of AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. The government says it intends to close loopholes in the legislation so the tech is included. Amendments will also be made to the Crime and Policing Bill to ensure chatbots protect users from illegal content. New rules aim to speed up coroners informing Ofcom about the death of a child so the regulator can order tech companies to preserve their data if it's relevant to how they died. A public consultation begins next month on a possible social media ban for under-16s, restricting their access to AI chatbots and limiting infinite scrolling. The government says it will respond quickly, but critics are concerned this could mean government giving itself powers to change laws without due process. While the wheels were already in motion for some of the measures announced today, they're a clear sign from Downing Street that protecting children online remains a top priority.
The BBC has learned the Prime Minister is considering making a significant increase in defence spending. Downing Street is exploring the idea of meeting an existing spending target earlier than planned at a potential cost of billions of pounds. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has the story.
The government's promised to spend more on defence. Its target is 2.5% of national wealth by 2027, with an ambition of reaching 3% in the next parliament. I understand the Prime Minister's considering meeting that 3% ambition earlier, potentially by the end of this parliament. His aim would be twofold, to cover existing defence costs, but also to meet future challenges. As he told the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, to meet the wider threat, it is clear we're going to have to spend more faster. His problem is that achieving the 3% target early would be expensive, costing as much as £14 billion a year. And that would mean more taxes, borrowing or cuts elsewhere. Downing Street said no decisions had been made about the defence investment plan. The MOD said it would not comment on speculation.
BBC Panorama has found evidence suggesting that a man who spent 23 years in prison for murder was framed by the police. 13 witnesses have told the programme they were pressured to exaggerate their statements or lie at the trial of Omar Benguet. In their response, Dorset Police didn't directly address the suggestion that officers had framed Benguet, but said their investigation had been thorough, detailed and very complex. Bronner Munro reports.
Yong-ok Shin, a South Korean student, was stabbed to death while walking home from a Bournemouth nightclub in 2002. Omar Benguet was convicted of her murder, but there was no CCTV or forensic evidence linking him to the crime, and the only eyewitness had a history of making false allegations. Police had also seen CCTV footage that contradicted her account. They built a case around her anyway, and supported her story with circumstantial evidence from other witnesses. 13 of them have now told me they were pressured by the police to give false evidence. Dorset Police said the case had already been dismissed twice by the Court of Appeal, and its thoughts were with the victim's family and friends.
BBC News understands that the front-runner to become the government's most senior civil servant was spoken to about her management and leadership style after an inquiry into a complaint against her. Dame Antonia Romeo is currently one of three people sharing the role of Cabinet Secretary on a temporary basis. An investigation into a single complaint against her in 2017 found there was no case to answer. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
In 2017, Dame Antonia Romeo was investigated after a single complaint made allegations of bullying and about her use of expenses. The BBC has seen a letter sent by the government's head of HR at the time that told her there was no case to answer. But a source said there were tough conversations with Dame Antonia at the time about her leadership style. That was not an easy conversation. She took her medicine, they said. It comes after the former head of the Foreign Office, Lord MacDonald, made an unusual intervention last week, telling Channel 4 News more due diligence was needed if Antonia Romeo was to be appointed Cabinet Secretary. That has prompted anger from many civil servants who have defended her record. One official who worked with her recently said they were baffled and outraged by Lord MacDonald's suggestion. A Cabinet Office spokesperson said Antonia Romeo is an outstanding leader with a 25-year record of excellent public service.
The Conservatives are calling on Labour to suspend its links with a prominent think tank after it commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of a number of journalists. Labour Together, which helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership, asked the US lobbying firm ACPO in 2023 to look into the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times story about the think tank's donations. The group's leader at the time, Josh Simons, who's now a cabinet office minister, has said ACPO strayed beyond its brief. The Home Office has paid out tens of thousands of pounds in compensation to migrants who crossed the Channel in small boats after their mobile phones were unlawfully seized. The reimbursements relate to some asylum seekers whose phones were confiscated when they arrived in the UK in 2020. Nick Johnson reports.
The High Court ruled in 2022 that confiscating phones from asylum seekers violated data protection laws and the European Convention on Human Rights. At the time, the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, admitted mobile phones had been unlawfully seized from migrants who'd crossed the Channel on small boats. The Sun newspaper says a Freedom of Information request shows the government has since paid more than £200,000 in compensation to more than 30 asylum seekers. The Home Office said the compensation was a result of the previous Conservative government's policy, which now no longer exists, and that phones belonging to migrants can now be legally seized as a result of a change in the law, which was introduced last month.
The final set of hearings at the UK COVID-19 public inquiry begins today. This phase will look at the impact of the pandemic on society, with a focus on mental health, key workers, the most vulnerable, and those who were bereaved. The hearings are set to last 3 weeks. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
Previous modules of the inquiry have looked at decisions made by governments, political leaders and officials during the pandemic. This final phase will focus on the impact on people and different sections of society. The hearings began in June 2023 and will end next month. There have been 10 modules looking at different aspects of the pandemic. The final report on subjects covered will come in 2027. It's estimated the inquiry has cost £200 million so far. Officials say it's had the broadest scope of any UK public inquiry and is relevant to the whole population.
Gardeners are being asked to help the Royal Horticultural Society revive a rare pink daffodil species. The charity is inviting anyone who grows the flower to send bulbs to its research facility in Wisley in Surrey after they've bloomed this spring, as Rebecca Drought explains.
With apologies to Wordsworth, many of us will think of hosts of golden daffodils when conjuring pictures of the traditional spring flowers. But there are 30,000 varieties in the UK, and 6% of those recorded by the RHS last year were reported to contain pink, green and red. It's these rare plants the charity wants to find, especially Mrs. R.O. Backhouse daffodils, which have a solid coral pink trumpet and ivory flowers. The RHS says it wants to find varieties in decline and help maintain plant diversity, it says offers potential benefits for both people and the planet.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. It's now 7:10. You probably expect the Kremlin or Beijing or Tehran to investigate the personal, political and religious views of journalists whose stories they don't like. You might not expect a minister in a British government to have done the same thing. But this morning, calls are mounting for an investigation into the actions of the Cabinet Office Minister Josh Simons, who, before he was in government, hired lobbyists to investigate a Sunday Times reporter whose stories were proving troublesome for the influential think tank Labour Together, which he used to run and which played such a crucial role in helping to get Sir Keir Starmer elected. We can talk now to the editor of the paper who hired the journalist involved, Gabriel Pogrand. He is Ben Taylor and joins us now alongside John McDonnell, Labour MP, former Shadow Chancellor, Secretary of the NUJ Parliamentary Group. Good morning to you both.
Morning. Good morning.
Starting with you, Ben, for those who have not followed the detail of this story, why are you shocked? And it is clear that you are shocked by what happened to one of your journalists.
Thanks, Nick. Well, look. The rough and tumble of journalism politics is just that, and we don't normally complain when people complain about us. We're critical of politicians, and you know there'll be times when they're fed up with that. That's all perfectly natural and healthy, and part of the tension between the free press and the governing classes. But on this occasion, I just think it went way too far. I mean, as you rightly summarised, it was a story that appeared in November 2023 by Gabriel. It was a very embarrassing story for the Labour Party, in particular Morgan McSweeney, who was obviously integral to the electoral strategy because he was involved in Labour Together fundraising. But the problem was that the Labour Together hadn't declared around £750,000 to the Electoral Commission. Now, we discovered that they hadn't done this. We discovered that they'd been fined, and we ran a story on page one, as I said, in November 2023. But their response wasn't just to apologise, accept they got something wrong and learn from it. It was to, as you describe, engage what I would describe as sometimes a corporate intelligence firm to try and analyse the sourcing, the origins and the funding of the story. It was a very, very odd thing to do. Now, they claim today that they thought they'd been hacked. Now, fine. I mean, anyone, any institution that's been hacked is entitled to investigate that. But APCO, which is the firm in question, is not a cybersecurity firm. It essentially, it's all about reputational management. And they engaged a former member of the Sunday Times, someone who I didn't employ, to start an inquiry.
You basically think this is a spy job and then smearing, but Josh Simons, to be clear, uses the words that you've just read out, that the contract that he had was to investigate the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times article. It was not smear the reporter behind it, and he says he's surprised and shocked to read what came out.
Well, I know, and look, he's entitled to his views now. The problem is for him is that back then this report was submitted. It complained extraordinary details, or frankly, lies about Gabriel, which went way beyond anything that you might expect to read. And frankly, some of it is so offensive, I wouldn't even read it out on the radio. Some of it was in the Sunday Times yesterday, talking about his family background, his faith, questioning his impartiality, questioning the way he'd reported on the Corbyn years as well, in very offensive terms regarding anti-Semitism.
So the question is, what you think should happen now? Because Josh Simons goes further. This is the minister who used to run Labour together and says it went beyond the contract by including what he calls unnecessary information.
But that's not
on
good enough, Nick, you see. It's just not good enough because the fact is, when the report came in, Labour Together people, some of whom are now in the cabinet, were quite happy to talk about its conclusions widely around Westminster, claim that the Sunday Times was being used by the Russian state to run disobliging stories about Labour, and frankly cast doubt on both the title and its reporters in the run-up to the general election.
So briefly, if you would, Ben, what in summary, forgive me, but what in summary do you want?
I would like some honesty from people at Labour Together. We've not heard from Mr McSweeney. Josh Simons has come up with a partial account. There are other cabinet ministers, Steve Reid, Lisa Nandy, who were involved in Labour Together at the time. They know who they are. They need to be honest about what the motivations of this were. But crucially, when the report landed, why was it that our reporters around Westminster were then subject to a whispering campaign about their motivations? And those people who did that know exactly who they are. They know, and some of them are very senior in the government indeed. And I think this is what really angered me. Number one, it was the attack on Gabriel. Two was the attack on the institution of the Sunday Times, which, as I say, we're used to being criticised. That's fine. But this was much more insidious. And three, the fact is they ran with those conclusions in and around Westminster to try and get up a campaign that you cannot trust the Sunday Times. They're essentially being used by a foreign state, which is the most absurd thing I've ever heard.
Ben Taylor, editor of the Sunday Times, thank you. Just before we turn to John McDonnell, let me just tell you what Labour Together are saying. Their chief executive has written to her staff last night to say she was horrified that investigators hired by Labour Together would look into the background and sources of reporters, and the company, APCO Worldwide, say, and I quote, they're deeply committed to upholding our values and standards and treat any suggestion we failed to do so very seriously. Well, John McDonnell, do all those statements do enough for you?
Not really. Nick, just give me 10 seconds to explain my role. Can I am the secretary of the NUJ parliamentary group. I've been involved in the group and secretary for about 20 years. We've been raising the cases of freedom of journalists across the world, in Russia, in Iran, Gaza. And nearly 2 weeks ago, I was approached by Peter Gagan, the investigative journalist from Democracy for Sale. He took me through this story. I was a bit shocked, but they're all allegations. So I wrote to the, I'm a Labour MP, so I wrote to the secretary of the General Secretary of the Labour Party, and said that I think this warrants an investigation, because if any of this is accurate, it's really shocking. I tried to get the Labour Party to be ahead of the game, because I thought at least what the Labour Party could do, say, acknowledge there might be a problem here, and then announce that there's going to be an independent investigation, and that would have at least been able to get somewhere near the truth. I got a reply from the General Secretary that said this isn't a Labour organisation, even though I said, look, it's managed and controlled by Labour Party members, quite senior Labour Party members. And I was referred to the complaints department about individual members of the party. And I said, that doesn't meet the seriousness of this case.
Just spell that out, would you, John? Because you raised Russia, you raised Iran. For people who may think this is all complicated, murky goings on in Westminster, are you saying that we are seeing or have seen the sort of behaviour that you would expect to see from an undemocratic regime in its attitude to journalists?
That's the allegation being levelled against Labour together. And so you know what it's like as a journalist. If someone damages your reputation, it could be career-ending, couldn't it? You could have your reputation damaged, and actually it damages your potential as a future journalist. And so I thought, this is serious allegations. The Labour Party should get on top of it at the earliest stage. And I've written four times now to the General Secretary of the Labour Party, including to Keir Starmer, to say this is serious. Launch an investigation. That's not happened. So
I'm very worried, John, if I could.
About the standing of the Labour Party, yeah, as well as the protection of journalists in this country.
Forgive me, but you'll know what they'll say about you. Say, John McDonnell on the left, an old Corbynite, yeah, wants to nobble Labour together, yeah, because it's an election-winning machine for Keir Starmer, yeah, and for the right of your party, and you'd love to do them real damage.
Well, let me two things on that. One, in my role as Secretary of the NEJ Parliamentary Group, this is the role I play in protecting journalists. And we've seen, it isn't just Sunday Times journalists, they attacked Paul Holden as well, who originally exposed the role that Labour Together played in not declaring its funding of Keir Starmer's campaign. That's the first thing. That's my role. But secondly, it's this. I'm a Labour MP. I want to protect the reputation of the Labour Party overall. This isn't about individuals, it's the party's standing amongst the general public, and this damages even further. And you know, every time I say something, if you're on the left, you're told you're the usual suspect. Well, in future, maybe you say he's the usual suspect, but actually he was right over the appointment of Peter Mandelson, he was right over the two-child limit, he was right over the winter fuel allowance, and he was right about making sure the Labour Party investigates matters like this so it maintains its reputation. So just because I'm on the left, I don't believe on that track record of actually being correct on these issues, my view should be in some way dismissed, particularly when it's a serious matter about threatening the professional lives of journalists in this country.
John McDonnell, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And incidentally, APCO, the company involved, say they're doing an internal review of the project and their discussion with their trade body called the PRCA, who've got their own review into the matter.
We'll put some of those thoughts to the Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, as well when she joins us on the programme at 10 past 8 this morning. It is 20 past 7 now. Loopholes in the Online Safety Act will be closed faster, so says the government, which is announcing new measures to protect children today, alongside ones that we did already know about. Things like age limits, addictive design features, AI chatbots will all be looked at. But there is some criticism as well that the tech is moving far more quickly than the legislation is actually keeping up with it. Well, Lord Nash, John Nash, is the founder of Future Academies, former Conservative Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for Schools. Good morning.
Morning.
As I said there, some of this, well, a little bit of this today is new. A lot of it is things we already knew. What do you think needs to be happening right now to try and deal with some of these problems that are well identified?
Well, I think what the government should do is accept my amendment to raise the age limit for access to certain social media sites to 16. This amendment passed overwhelmingly in the Lords and now goes to the Commons. And one has to be pretty cynical about this. They came up with this idea of a consultation the day before the vote in the Lords in an attempt to head off, unsuccessfully to head off the vote. And now in an attempt to head off their backbenchers in the Commons, they're announcing this, but it doesn't really tell us much more than we knew already.
Is a consultation a wholly terrible thing, though? Because it's a big change. It's one that under 16-year-olds won't be delighted about. Is there an argument for actually spending some time looking at this?
Well, under my amendment, we would have 12 months to actually affect anything, so there'd be plenty of time to consider how you did it. But this consultation is not about about how you do it. It's a question of whether we do anything at all. And so I just think that we should get on with it. And I know the government are very fond of consultations. They're running 81 of them at the moment. But if I tell you that the gender identity in schools consultation, which closed 2 years ago, they've only just announced 2 years later what action they propose to take as a result of that consultation. And they've only announced that because we called them out on this during the course of this debate. So, again, I say one has to be pretty cynical that this is purely a political manoeuvre to head off losing votes in the Parliament.
What about the wider issue? And you talked about your amendment there, which deals with one element of it. But this technology, it is moving so very quickly. Can something like legislation ever realistically keep up with it?
Well, it's always going to be playing catch-up to an extent. But the trouble with legislation, the trouble with the Online Safety Act, which clearly hasn't worked, is one's putting, and social media companies are very good at this, is persuading governments that the onus should be on them, the governments, when in fact what we need to do is put the onus on the companies.
So how do we do that?
Well, under my amendment, you'd say to the companies that if your app had certain features which are harmful to children, whether that's addiction, scrolling, ability for strangers to access you, whatever, then you can't sell these products to children under the age of 16.
But if you want companies to sell them to children, they're not going to say, great, lovely, that's what we'll do. You know, they're pushing very hard for this not to happen.
Well, they are going to push that, and they have a massive lobbying votes. But I've spoken to the companies, and actually the message I get from them is, if this is a level playing field for all of them, then they may accept it's going to happen. It's happening all over the world. It's happening in Australia, New Zealand, Malaysia, across Europe. The European Parliament voted overwhelmingly for an age limit of 16. And if quite a lot of their income is being lost as a result of not being able to sell these products to under 16-year-olds, then they will produce products which do not have these harmful features, which they can sell to them. We have to put the onus on the social media companies.
They're not going to do it proactively, though, are they?
No, which is why we need to have firm measures, like my amendment, rather than overlaying more complications on the Online Safety Act and Ofcom regime, which has clearly failed. And if you put more measures on top of that, then it will continue to fail.
Lord Nash, thank you for joining us. We will discuss this a little more, as I said, after 8 o'clock this morning.
It is 7:24 now. Employers have been highly critical, many of them at least, of the new Employment Rights Act. And in a new report, more than a third of employers say they plan to reduce the recruitment of permanent staff due to those new rights. Leanna can tell us more.
Yeah, that's right, Nick. It's the latest labour market outlook report from the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. And it's saying hiring intentions are at their lowest level outside the first year of the pandemic. Peter Cheese is the chief executive of the CIPD. Peter, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, how certain are you that this is down to the reforms and not simply weak business confidence more broadly?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question. I mean, we've seen recruitment intentions dropping in recent months. Concern about increasing employment costs, obviously the national insurance was a particular aspect of it. But there's no doubt the businesses are feeling sensitive to the many different legislative changes in the Employment Rights Act. And areas such as statutory sick pay and some of the risks that they might see around the unfair dismissal qualification period reducing. So it's both risk and cost, I think, that employers are sensitive to here.
But are employers telling you they would be hiring more if these reforms weren't coming in?
No, I don't think they're saying that exactly. As you said, I mean, it's a combination of factors which is slowing recruitment demand. It's important that, of course, businesses do continue to hire. That's about their future workforce, but also showing that they have the confidence and growth in the future.
Now, Peter, we asked the government for a response to the report, and Minister for Employment Rights, Kate Dearden, said, "We've been backing employers from day one with our Employment Rights Act, with the reforms set to boost productivity and retention in workplaces across the UK and give job security to over 18 million workers." What do you think about that? And also, did you help advise the government on the Act? Did you raise concerns then?
Yes, first of all, I think we all understand what the intentions were behind this. So things like day one rights and security of employment and so forth. And yes, we were. We were directly involved from day one in the consultation, so-called tripartite consultations, as the CIPD, as the professional body for HR. I think the principles are understood, but it is about the often unintended consequences and the sheer amount of change. The government itself has acknowledged this is the biggest set of changes to employment legislation in a generation. So it's a lot for businesses to absorb, particularly smaller businesses. And the government have also estimated that it will cost as much as £1 billion in terms of additional costs for employment right across the United Kingdom. And that includes things like training managers properly, training HR professionals properly, making sure the businesses are properly prepared to absorb these changes and mitigate the risks that we've highlighted.
But very quickly, are they prepared?
I think many, what the survey, our labour market outlook is showing is clearly that many are not well prepared and understanding all of the detail. And so one of our key asks, two or three key asks, first is that the government continues meaningful consultation and are prepared to compromise in order to mitigate risks where you see that necessary. Mm. But there is also that there is a clear campaign to raise awareness, particularly amongst smaller businesses, and to provide the support and guidance that we're all going
Peter,
to need.
We'll leave it there. Peter Cheese, Chief Executive of the CIBD. Thank you so much.
Leanna, thank you very much indeed. It's 28 minutes past seven. If you need a cheering up, if you need to escape the rain and watch the telly, listen to the radio. The Olympics cheered you up yesterday, Harthy, didn't they?
It did. Brilliant coverage on both, as you mentioned, actually, television and radio, of Team GB winning 3 gold medals at the Winter Olympics for the first time. Matt Weston added mixed team skeleton gold alongside Tabby Stoker to his individual gold medal in the skeleton. And Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale won the snowboard cross mixed team event. And I'm very pleased to say that we can speak to the CEO of GB Snowsport, Vicky Gosling. Morning and congratulations. Banks and Nightingale, yes, with that first ever gold medal for Great Britain and Northern Ireland on snow at the Winter Olympics. 102 years, I think it has been. How have you built, I suppose, to finally achieving this?
You know, it's been a journey, but it's been fantastic. I mean, we went to Beijing, we delivered no medals, and we came back fighting. We refocused, we re-energised, and actually we then decided we were going to come back and show the world what we were truly made of. And in the last sort of 3 seasons, actually, we've been on an upward trajectory. We've been able to win. We've had 10 world champions. We've had 18 Crystal Globes, and we've demonstrated actually that Britain has got what it takes to win. But of course, the Olympics is where it's truly amplified. And then being able to demonstrate that we had what it takes on the world class stage at the Olympics with the first ever, gold medal on snow in a team event of all things, which is very much the foundation of who we are, was just fantastic. I mean, absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was to watch and to listen to. You mentioned there the team events. There are a lot of mixed team events, aren't there? All sports are keen to engage and widen audience and participation. How are you seeing the team events perhaps changing the dynamics of your sport?
Well, yeah, we've always been pretty much about team. It's the basis of who we are. You know, I always say I use the matchstick analogy, actually. As a single matchstick, you can get broken, but when you're surrounded in a bundle, it's really tough to break you. And I think that foundation has really brought us to where we are. But when you've got somebody else at the start line with you and you're dependent on each other, I think that really brings out a different sort of esprit de corps and this amazing commitment and courage and belief in what they're capable of. And, you know, we watched Hugh sort of bored within an inch of his life, and then you saw Charlotte, you know, chasing him down and overtaking the French at the last minute. I mean, it's a little bit like Formula One of snow sport, I would suggest. So it's fantastic, and the team events are always really exciting because they come together and then you know, together they win. It's such a great story.
And it is that first medal on snow. Both Charlotte and Hugh lived abroad, I think, from the ages of 4 and 5. Is it a bit basic to say that the lack of snowy mountains and freestyle courses has proved challenging for British athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very true. If you think about, the fact that we aren't a nation with snow and mountain ranges, but you just have to look at Mia Brooks, Kirsty Muir, you know, they've just sort of been pipped in their fourth positions, but they were brought up in Manchester and Aberdeen. And we actually have, 60 plus facilities within the UK to get your basic fundamentals sorted. So our Grom camps, building those skills that you need in between sort of, you know, those ages of 6 through to 12 are quite fundamental. And you can certainly do that within the UK. And thanks to, the National Lottery, I have to say, investing in those facilities for us and investing in our sport, we wouldn't be where we are without that and without those amazing lottery players. So, Yeah, you know, you can start it in the UK, and even Dave Ryden, we're off to see him today. You know, everybody knows his story of learning on the dry slopes. And then you just take it from there, and we do what we can accessing Europe and obviously mountain ranges, so we can put what we've learned in the snow domes into real snow.
Yeah, and you've mentioned, I think GB Snow Sport set a target in 2018 for Great Britain to become a top five snow sport nation by 2030. I presume that's still the case. How much do you need financially from UK sport, and how much of that is needing to be sourced from sponsorship and commercial revenue?
Yeah, well, it's a real combination. You know, as I say, we wouldn't have even been able to start the flywheel effect without the funding that we've had from the National Lottery to date. But the reality is, the more you invest, the greater the opportunity. And because we don't have, the mountain ranges, the snow on the doorstep, we do actually have to travel. I think because of, you know, climate change, Southern Hemisphere training in the summer is really important, and that costs money. So we've been, over the last, year, we've really been driving commercial partnerships as well to supplement the money that we get, which we're grateful for, and that's really helped. But I would say, the more investment you put in, the greater the results you see. And we're up against, we're up against nations like, the United States, who probably have around 60 million a year of funding to take their athletes where they need to go. And we at the moment probably receive about 1.7 per year, so about 7.2 over a 4-year period. So the greater the amount, the greater the results. That said, we are extremely grateful for what we already receive.
Well, first gold is fantastic. Vicky Gosling, CEO of GB Snow Sport, thank you very much. And you'll be speaking to Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker, more gold medalists later in the hour.
Yeah, we're excited about that. If you want to know what it's like to hurtle down a mountain on a tea tray at enormous speed without any breaks in the ice, you're about to find out.
Hello, I'm Jill Scott.
And I'm Joe Marler. And because this is radio, you can't see that Jill here is dressed as an 80s disco queen. And I'm wearing an inflatable flamingo costume.
Because for Red Nose Day, we're taking ourselves a little less seriously to help do some serious good.
And you can too. Just head online and get a fundraising pack, get loads of...
Oh no, Joe, you've popped again, man.
I knew this wasn't my size.
Take yourself funny for money for comic relief.
Where's the foot pump?
Get a fundraising pack today. Just search Red Nose Day.
The weather today will be windy with the inevitable rains in the form of scattered showers today, mostly in the north and the west.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. At 26 minutes to 8, Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer says no online platform will get a free pass on children's safety as the government moves to accelerate the closing of gaps in online protection laws. The Online Safety Act was drafted before the arrival of AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. Campaigners and bereaved parents have welcomed the move. The BBC has learned that the Prime Minister is considering making a significant increase in defence spending. Downing Street is exploring the idea of meeting the 3% spending ambition by the end of the current Parliament rather than the next. It would come at a potential cost of up to £14 billion a year. The aim would be to cover existing defence costs, but also to meet future challenges. BBC News understands the front-runner to become the government's most senior civil servant was spoken to about her management style following an inquiry into a complaint. Dame Antonia Romeo is currently one of three officials sharing the role of Cabinet Secretary on a temporary basis. An investigation into a single complaint made about her in 2017 concluded there was no case to answer. The Conservatives are calling on Labour to suspend its links with the think tank Labour Together after it commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of several journalists. In 2023, the group asked a US lobbying firm, APCO, to examine the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times story about its donations. Labour Together's then-leader Josh Simons, who's now a Cabinet Office Minister, says the firm went beyond its brief. In a statement, APCO said it was reviewing the work and treating very seriously the suggestion it failed to uphold standards. The final hearings of the UK COVID-19 public inquiry begin today. Over the next 3 weeks, the inquiry will examine the wider impact of the pandemic on society, including mental health, key workers, the most vulnerable and the bereaved. The hearings are set to last 3 weeks.
Chris, thank you. 24 minutes to eight now. Student loans have been in the spotlight in the last few weeks, with stories of people who paid thousands of pounds towards them, then finding the overall total they owe has actually increased rather than decreased. A campaign to change Plan 2 loans, as they're called, this particular type of loan, has been led by, among others, money-saving expert Martin Lewis. He said that freezing repayment thresholds for some borrowers was not a moral thing to do, while the Chancellor has called it fair and reasonable. Well, Matilda Davies is a journalist at the time. She's a senior data journalist, but she was a student, and like many others, she has a growing student loan.
I borrowed £38,000 for my undergraduate degree about 10 years ago, and then an additional £11,000 for my postgraduate degree. So I borrowed £49,000 in total. And despite the fact that I've been paying it off for almost 10 years now, my balance is now £67,000. The interest on Plan 2 loans, I just think is a little bit ridiculous. You know, I'm in a good, well-paying job and I still don't clear the interest every month. So my balance just goes up and up and up. My loan is a Plan 2 loan, so the interest on mine is RPI plus 3%, which is well above any of the other plans. It's obviously well above inflation. So I think one of the main things that I would like to see happen is for that interest rate to be cut. And ideally for the interest rates for the different plans to be brought in line with each other. One of the things I also think is really unfair about student loans is that Rachel Reeves has frozen the threshold. When I was at school, I don't think I really understood what I was signing up for. It was not made clear to me how much of a difference this would make to my life and to the money I get every month. But one of the things I was signing up for was for a loan that would, where the thresholds would increase with the average salary, and banks wouldn't be allowed to change those terms retrospectively, and I don't think the government should be allowed to either.
That is Matilda Davies, one of those former students who's really seeing the impact of those changes now. Well, let's discuss this with Lord Willetts, David Willetts, who was Universities Minister at the time when these changes happened. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi.
I imagine listening to Matilda there and some of those numbers that she's talking about, that was never your intention.
We certainly said when we amended the system back then, 15 years ago, and I said that I expected that the repayment threshold would go up with earnings every year. And our focus was very much on how much cash people actually had to pay back every month, every year. It's why we increased the repayment threshold from the previous scheme up to that what was then £21,000. And I do think it's right that it should be uprated every year. And one of the reasons for the controversy at the moment is this freeze, which people weren't expecting.
That's a big part of it, isn't it? The fact that people weren't expecting it. And as Matilda pointed out there, these decisions are being taken by, well, it's when you're still an A-level student, essentially, when you're looking at the choices, you're accepting your place. And was it always too complicated a concept for people of that age to really understand what they were signing up to?
Well, I think the basic concept, which is if you go to university, you're then expected to pay back. But it's not like a credit card debt or an overdraft. You pay back when your earnings are above a certain threshold. I think that concept, which has actually been the one that all main parties have operated in higher education for 20 years.
The concept, yes, but the detail.
Yeah. Yeah. And what we then did, and I hope this, I think this scheme should be revived. We had recent graduates, money savvy recent graduates that we sent to every school and college for people at the absolutely that stage of their lives, 16 to 18, to explain the system and answer any questions about it. Of course, then a lot of the concern was some people thought they were going to have to pay up front. And obviously they explained that. But they were absolutely explaining the details of the system. And I do think that it's actually legitimate to change it. I think it should be reviewed. Exactly how you calibrate it, what the repayment threshold would be, this issue around interest rates, which now is causing people so much concern. All those should be reviewed every 5 years in the light of what's happening to earnings, what's happening to graduates. And then if you do it openly and make the trade-offs, how much should people be reasonably expected to pay back? I think the system would be much more accepted and understood if you have that that public consultation and a public decision, what are the fair basis on which graduates should pay back?
Your former special advisor, Nick Hillman, who was with you at the time that this was happening, he's spoken to The Times, and he, in his words, he said the system was created in a mad rush in 2010 when the government was under pressure from voters to save money, identifying that there were areas that had been protected and higher education spending was not one of them. Looking back, if you hadn't had that looming over you, choices like, for example, RPI plus 3%, would you have made those choices?
Well, there have been times since when the rate of inflation has been much higher than we expected. And also, of course, subsequently, and I regret this, subsequently a decision was taken to get rid of maintenance grants, which meant that the total amount of debt became bigger because maintenance loans were bigger as well. So there were those changes from what we expected. But remember, there had been a review. In fact, there have now been three main reviews over the last 15 or 20 years. We'd had Lord Brown's review that reported to us. We didn't accept everything, but we accepted a lot of it. And so we were acting on a consultation that had happened and a review that had been consulted. What I would like to see now, though, as I say, is a much more considered and careful process every few years of saying what exactly should we have, what should the repayment terms be. I think there's a very strong argument, of course, for CPI, not RPI. I also do think that the most recent proposal in the last review that you should cap the total amount of graduate debt at, say, I think the proposal was 120% of the total debt, some limit so that people don't think it's just growing, going without limit, would I think also be a good proposal to look at.
You said there was a very strong argument for changing away from RPI, which is an outdated method, across to CPI. Is now the time for that to happen? You said there was a strong argument, but should that be taken on now?
Yes, I think it should. It definitely should. But as part of a wider settlement, as I don't want to reopen the total debate, all political parties in power have accepted that you have to have some kind of graduate repayment system, and it shouldn't be like a mortgage. It should be sensitive to your income. But exactly how you calibrate it, exactly what the terms are, I think that does need to be looked at every few years in the lights of change of circumstances. I think the system that and that preserves the system and makes it, people can understand that it's a reasonable way of doing it, provided they understand what the terms are and that they've been properly considered and all the trade-offs properly considered.
Lord Willetts, former Universities Minister, thank you for joining us.
It's now 16 minutes to 8. Can Iran and the United States make a deal which limits its nuclear programme and averts another war in the Middle East? And if they do, will that be because Donald Trump has abandoned his threat to topple a regime that murdered thousands of its own citizens who dared to take to the streets to protest, and which in recent decades has armed and funded groups which target Western interests all over the Middle East? Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is in the Iranian capital, Tehran. She's been speaking to Iran's deputy foreign minister and reports on the condition that none of the material used is used on the BBC's Persian service, the same restrictions that apply to all international media organisations operating in the country. Good morning to you, Lise. Can we begin by talking about the thing that overshadows these talks, that massive US military build-up in the region? How much anxiety is it creating where you are?
Yes, what President Trump calls his beautiful armada, and the armada is getting more powerful by the day with that second strike carrier group heading to the Arabian Sea. President Trump has said that fear is an important factor, he says, in trying to push the Iranians towards a deal. It's a classic negotiating tactic. Iran, of course, says that, at least the leadership says, well, we're not scared. We're ready for war. If it's going to be a war, bring it on. Both sides saying that if there is a war, it'll be worse than the 12-day war of last year between Israel and Iran, which drew in the United States. And of course, what they say to us here is that they are ready to negotiate, and it's the other side holding it up. We heard from Secretary of State Marco Rubio over the weekend. He said President Trump prefers a deal. He prefers to avoid a war. But in his words, getting a deal with Iran is very hard to get. It is going to be hard to get. But for those who want there to be negotiations, and not everyone does. Some would like to see a war on this side and on the other side. At least the two sides can sit down and try to get some clarity about what each side is looking for and just how wide those gaps are, and can they be closed?
Now, one of the gaps appears to be that while the Deputy Foreign Minister of Iran said to you that he was up for, quote, compromise, it sounded, Lise, as if he was saying, we will only talk about our nuclear programme. If you want to talk about our other activities in the region, the allegation that Iran funds and arms terror groups all over the Middle East, that isn't on the table.
There's great scepticism, Nick, on all sides as to whether a deal can be done. But I think it is within reach to have a very narrow nuclear deal. And that's the message we got here yesterday from talking to Takhar Avanchi. He's not just the deputy foreign minister. He's one of the top two negotiators at the table. Iran is saying, OK, your suspicions about our nuclear program, we will dilute that highly enriched uranium, enriched to 60%, which is very close to weapons grade. There's also been an offer, we understand, to suspend nuclear enrichment, not to stop it, but to suspend it. They see those as compromises, which they're willing to do in exchange for the lifting of sanctions. We really see here just how people are suffering from sanctions. You know, Nick, on today, you often talk about the cost of living crisis. It's hurting, hitting the pocketbooks of people across Britain. Here, it's just off the charts, sky high. The prices go up from 1 month to the next, sometimes 1 day to the next, 60% inflation. What is it in Britain? Around 4%. But for there are some in the U.S. administration and possibly even President Trump, certainly Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, saying a deal on nuclear is not a deal at all. If you want to achieve security, if you want to stop the threats from Iran, it has to include the ballistic missiles which hit Israel during the last wars. It has to include their activities across the region. And so, as always, it comes down to President Trump. What does he want?
Lise Doucette, our Chief International Correspondent in Tehran, thank you.
It's 12 minutes to 8. Time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge.
Good morning. How do you feel about mind control? New research from a laboratory in Zurich suggests it may be possible to make people less selfish by sending electrical currents through their brains. 44 volunteers were asked to divide money between themselves and an anonymous partner. Remarkably, when certain neural pathways at the front and the back of the head were stimulated, participants gave more away. It sounds like science fiction. But other forms of biohacking are, of course, already common. Weight loss drugs, metabolic trackers, sleep technology. Medicines are routinely used to lift mood, sharpen attention, steady anxiety. So why not use science to make us kinder as well? That way we might all become more beautiful people, inside as well as out. Just imagine it. Wellness centres offering holistic packages, body and soul. Botox top-ups in the morning, altruistic boosting in the afternoon. More seriously, researchers claim this new technology could be used for the treatment of certain brain disorders and prove invaluable for people who struggle with social behaviour. It could be just the nudge they need to become better citizens. It's a wholesome idea. Yet as I read the academic article on this impressive experiment in brain hacking, forecasting gains in cooperation, productivity, and cohesion, I became increasingly uneasy. I was put in mind of Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel Brave New World, published almost a century ago, which describes a civilization held together not by conscience, but by chemistry and conditioning, a terrifying vision. Once virtue is treated as something that can be engineered, the line between encouragement and enforcement grows thin. A society might become more efficient, more compliant, even more outwardly generous, and still lose its soul. Huxley warns that people who allow themselves to be controlled may eventually come to love their servitude. Even if such dystopian fears never come to pass, the ambition to control our moral impulses through technology raises questions about the nature of morality. Christian thought has long distinguished between shaping behaviour from the outside and forming the person from within. Charity, what theologians call caritas, is not simply a matter of generous action. Intention matters too. Affection that is freely given is what lends acts of generosity their meaning. Without it, they risk becoming little more than reflexes. It's fascinating to learn that science can influence our moral behaviour, but it's fatal to confuse this fact with morality itself. The Christian vision insists that a person is more than a set of automatic responses. Morality only makes sense if it is chosen. As a society, we have already surrendered ourselves to our smartphones, our computers, and our digital habits. Let's at least fight, while we can, to love one another freely.
That was Thought for the Day with Michael Hurley, Professor of Literature and Theology at the University of Cambridge. It's 8:09.
Now, it may still be raining. The news may be dominated by reports of bad behaviour, the threat of war and the horrors that lie online. But sport can still bring a smile to your face. Sport, that is, in which competitors run very fast, hurl themselves headfirst down the ice on a tea tray which has no brakes. And it turns out we're rather good at it. It is the skeleton.
The gap's growing. Has he pulled it out of the fire? He's quicker than Yunk. Two bends to go. Matt Weston for Great Britain. It's gold again. It's gold once more. Unbelievable. This is indeed a Super Sunday. Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker have won a gold medal in the first mixed team competition. We looked right up against it. But Matt Weston, again, sensational. Yes, you are right, Matt. Two golds.
And Matt and Tabby, I'm delighted to say, join us from the Winter Olympics. Morning, and many, many congratulations to you both.
Morning. Thank you very much.
Yeah, can I start with Tabby? Because you could barely speak yesterday after this. And so we ought to hear from you first. Give us your reaction now you've got your breath back.
Honestly, it's just absolutely incredible to hear that little snippet of Matt crossing the line. It brings back all the memories of the shock, the happiness, the pride that I felt for both of us to come away with that gold medal yesterday.
And we heard, Matt, that you, for those who weren't following it, got not one but two golds, one with Tabby, one on your own. It is a long way since you broke your back in Taekwondo. Yeah. Can you believe it?
Yeah, I actually redid it about 3 years ago, so I've done it twice now. So as you can probably imagine, skeleton isn't the most safest of sports, but it's a hell of a lot of fun when you get it right.
Yeah, Tabby, tell us about it, because you were a circus performer originally, weren't you? What on earth induced you to lie flat on a tea tray hurtling down at that speed?
I guess the circus definitely prepared me for the adrenaline. And then we had a talk with Lizzie Arnold when I was first starting the program, and she just like sparked some inspiration in me. You know, the fact that maybe one day we could achieve the things that she had. And I guess just with skeleton, the rest is history, you know, competing and just learning to love and cherish the sport.
Matt, when we heard about the programme just then, that's part of the key to it, isn't it? That this sport said, come and try us out and see if you love it.
Yeah, definitely. The sport kind of runs off people applying and basically giving it a shot and taking the opportunity with both hands. I didn't think that I would ever be going to the games competing in skeleton 9 years ago. But now, like I said, I've been doing it for 9 years and it's been an amazing journey. And I just say, anyone who thinks that that they can give these types of things a go or fancy throwing themselves head first down a mountain, then just grab these opportunities with both hands.
Well, it turns out there are rather more of those people than I imagine. There's 1,000 people who have applied in recent days. So you've done something for it. And the challenge, Tabby, surely, training in Britain, where there's not a lot of snow and there's very little ice, is you're not training, actually, are you, on the track of the sort that you compete in?
Yeah, definitely. We're at a disadvantage in Britain, you know, not having our own ice track as such. But we do have a push track where we can practice our starts at the University of Bath, which we're very fortunate to have. But, you know, it does mean that when we go into each season, the amount of runs, the amount of time we actually have doing our sport is so much less than a lot of the other nations. So to say that we've come away from this games, you know, with Matt, with the individual and us winning that gold yesterday, I think, you know, we've done amazing considering that.
I'm sure there are lots of keys to getting a medal, but give us a couple of hints, Matt. Is it that start, the speed of the start, and also presumably just an enormous amount of bottle not to break with your feet?
Yeah. I mean, there is definitely that kind of, you have to get your head around the fact that you do go 80 miles an hour plus without any brakes. So you kind of have to, there's that part of it. But I'd say to be a good skeleton athlete, you need three main things. You need the start, like you mentioned. We train a lot for that in the summer. We do a lot of time in the gym and do a lot of sprinting. You need to be good at sliding, and that takes a lot of reflexes, a lot of learning the tracks. We know every single corner off by heart. And also equipment. So that's a massive part of our sport and something that kind of goes unnoticed sometimes. But we spend a lot of time doing research and development and progressing on that side as well.
So, Tabby, the sleds are a bit like a Formula One car, aren't they? If you get it right, you've got a huge advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And everyone's sled will be slightly different, tailored to them and the way that they like to drive down the track. And then that's also dependent on different tracks that you're at and the weather conditions. So there's a lot of variables, but our team's absolutely smashed it.
Yeah. And did you allow yourself, Matt, a celebration? Because after you won the first gold on Friday night, you kind of had to be sensible, didn't you? Because you knew you were competing.
Yeah. Yeah, I was sensible after the team race. The individual, so I could make sure I was prepped for the team race yesterday. But I'm running on a lot of coffee this morning. I'll say that.
I've just been told that one of the other British medalists, gold medalists, Hugh Nightingale's parents yelled, "I changed his nappy," as you were crossing the line. Are your family and friends enjoying the party?
It appears so. It appears so.
I've broken news to you there. And I'm intrigued, Tabby. You were a circus performer. Matt can juggle on a unicycle, I'm told. And this is an alternative career when you get too old and too sensible to go down the track.
Yeah, I definitely think it's not, to be honest, it's not something we've ever spoke about doing that as a career afterwards. But now you've mentioned it, we should probably look into it.
Yeah, there's a kind of Torval and Dean possibility. We're coming back and talking
something like that
in 40 years' time. And meanwhile, Matt, you've got to go and get married.
Yes, yeah, that's something. I've got a big year, 2026. Obviously, the Olympics, which has been absolutely amazing and has been some of the best days of my life. But I can't really say that for too much longer because I'm getting married in July, which I'm so, so excited about. I've kind of been using the Olympics as an excuse to get out of a lot of the wedding planning. So I think I'm going to have to pull my finger out now.
And Tabby, he's not marrying you, but it's your boyfriend's the best man, I understand.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Skeleton has brought us all together and we're one big family and we all can't wait to be crying at Matt's wedding, watching his beautiful bride walk down the aisle.
Well, lots of people were crying with you yesterday and loving it. Now, I know we're talking on the radio, but hold up the medal so at least we can see it here in the studio. Or have you not got it?
They're in socks at the moment.
Oh, there we are.
I just slid mine out of the sock.
What? Oh, yeah, Tabby's medal I can see. The other one, Matt's in a sock to keep it safe. Oh, there they are. Lovely. Congratulations. Matt Weston, Tabby Stoker. Enjoy the day.
That really was a red and blue rolled up sock. He's going to have to get something a little better, a little fancier for that, isn't he? Let's check the weather. Here's Elizabeth Ritzini. Morning.
Good morning again, Anna. Some icy stretches actually for eastern Scotland and for the far northeast of England. Ice warnings here. There are some wintry showers around today over the higher ground of Scotland. The snow level's gradually dropping. Elsewhere, it's a largely frost-free start to the day. Rather cloudy across Northern Ireland. There'll be blustery showers for just about everywhere. Those showers tracking further south. Southwards and eastwards throughout the day, they're likely to band together to form quite organised or feel like spells of rain, I think, for much of the time. And those showers will gradually push further southwards and eastwards. Brisk northwesterly winds blowing. Most of the showers, I think, across northwest England. For Northern Ireland, some decent sunshine actually through the afternoon. There'll be some brighter spells in between those showers, of course, for most of us. Top temperatures of 6 to 11 degrees Celsius. And there'll be a frost overnight tonight.
Thank you, Elizabeth. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 16th of February. The headlines this morning. Sir Keir Starmer tells tech giants there'll be no free passes as the government sets out plans to speed up the closing of loopholes in online child safety laws. In a constantly shifting online world, will it work? We'll be talking to the Technology Secretary after this news bulletin. The BBC has learned that the Prime Minister is considering a significant increase in defence spending, and evidence seen by Panorama suggests a man who spent 23 years in prison for a murder in Bournemouth was framed by the police.
Also in the next hour of the programme, Alexander Litvinenko's widow joins us at 8:30 as the UK considers new sanctions against Russia. Is there anybody out there? President Obama seems to think so.
What was the first question you wanted answered when you became president? Where are the aliens?
Where are the aliens?
And? We will hear from the extraordinary woman celebrating her 81st birthday this week, taking part in a Wagner performance in the nude. Before that, the BBC News is read by Chris Aldridge.
The government is pledging to respond more quickly to close loopholes in laws designed to protect children online. Sir Keir Starmer says technology is moving really fast and no online platform will get a free pass. Campaigners and bereaved parents have welcomed the news, but opposition parties say ministers are not moving quickly enough to ban under-16s from social media, describing a consultation due to begin next month as inaction. Our technology editor Zoe Kleinman reports.
The Online Safety Act was written before the release of AI chatbots such as ChatGPT. The government says it intends to close loopholes in the legislation so the tech is included. Amendments will also be made to the Crime and Policing Bill to ensure chatbots protect users from illegal content. New rules aim to speed up coroners informing Ofcom about the death of a child so the regulator can order tech companies to preserve their data if it's relevant to how they died. A public consultation begins next month on a possible social media ban for under-16s, restricting their access to AI chatbots and limiting infinite scrolling. The government says it will respond quickly, but critics are concerned this could mean government giving itself powers to change laws without due process. While the wheels were already in motion for some of the measures announced today, they're a clear sign from Downing Street that protecting children online remains a top priority.
The BBC has learned the Prime Minister is considering making a significant increase in defence spending. Downing Street is exploring the idea of meeting an existing spending target earlier than planned at a potential cost of billions of pounds. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale has the story.
The government's promised to spend more on defence. Its target is 2.5% of national wealth by 2027, with an ambition of reaching 3% in the next parliament. I understand the Prime Minister's considering meeting that 3% ambition earlier, potentially by the end of this parliament. His aim would be twofold, to cover existing defence costs, but also to meet future challenges. As he told the Munich Security Conference at the weekend, to meet the wider threat, it is clear we're going to have to spend more, faster. His problem is that achieving the 3% target early would be expensive, costing as much as £14 billion a year. And that would mean more taxes, borrowing or cuts elsewhere. Downing Street said no decisions had been made about the defence investment plan. The MOD said it would not comment on speculation.
BBC Panorama has found evidence suggesting that a man who spent 23 years in prison for murder was framed by the police. 13 witnesses have told the programme they were pressured to exaggerate their statements or lie at the trial of Omar Benguit. In their response, Dorset Police didn't directly address the suggestion that officers had framed Benguit, but said their investigation had been thorough, detailed and very complex. Bronner Munro reports.
Yong-ok Shin, a South Korean student, was stabbed to death while walking home from a Bournemouth nightclub in 2002. Omar Benguit was convicted of her murder, but there was no CCTV or forensic evidence linking him to the crime, and the only eyewitness had a history of making false allegations. Police had also seen CCTV footage that contradicted her account. They built a case around her anyway, and supported her story with circumstantial evidence from other witnesses. 13 of them have now told me they were pressured by the police to give false evidence. Dorset Police said the case had already been dismissed twice by the Court of Appeal and its thoughts were with the victim's family and friends.
BBC News understands that the front runner to become the government's most senior civil servant was spoken to about her management and leadership style after an inquiry into a complaint against her. Dame Antonia Romeo is currently one of three people sharing the role of Cabinet Secretary on a temporary basis. An investigation into a single complaint against her in 2017 found there was no case to answer. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
In 2017, Dame Antonia Romeo was investigated after a single complaint made allegations of bullying and about her use of expenses. The BBC has seen a letter sent by the government's head of HR at the time that told her there was no case to answer. But a source said there were tough conversations with Dame Antonia at the time about her leadership style. It comes after the former head of the Foreign Office, Lord MacDonald, made an unusual intervention last week, telling Channel 4 News more due diligence was needed if Antonia Romeo was to be appointed Cabinet Secretary. A Cabinet Office spokesperson said, Antonia Romeo is an outstanding leader with a 25-year record of excellent public service.
The Conservatives are urging Labour to suspend its links with a prominent think tank after it commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of several journalists. Labour Together, which helped Sir Keir Starmer win the party leadership, asked the US lobbying firm APCO to examine the sourcing, funding and origins of a Sunday Times story about its donations in 2023. The group's then leader, Josh Simons, who's now a Cabinet Office Minister, says APCO had been asked to look into a potential hack and had strayed beyond its brief. The editor of the Sunday Times, Ben Taylor, told us he did not believe the explanation.
When the report came in, Labour Together people, some of whom are now in the Cabinet, were quite happy to talk about its conclusions widely around Westminster, claim that the Sunday Times was being used by the Russian state to run disobliging stories about Labour, and frankly cast doubt on both the title and its reporters in the run-up to the general election. And this is why their excuse won't wash.
The Labour MP, John McDonnell, who's secretary of the NUJ parliamentary group, told us his party's reputation was being damaged.
I thought this is serious allegations. The Labour Party should get on top of it at the earliest stage. I've written four times now to the General Secretary of the Labour Party, including to Keir Starmer, to say this is serious. Launch an investigation. But that's not happened. So I'm very worried about the standing of the Labour Party as well as the protection of journalists in this country.
In a statement, APCO said it was reviewing the work and treating very seriously the suggestion it failed to uphold standards. The US television presenter Savannah Guthrie has released a video appealing to her mother's kidnappers, urging her safe return. Nancy Guthrie, who's 84, has been missing for more than 2 weeks after disappearing from her home in Tucson in Arizona. Police believe she was abducted. From Tucson, our North America correspondent David Willis reports.
On the night she went missing, Nancy Guthrie's doorbell camera captured footage of a masked man wearing what appeared to be thick black gloves. A few days after her disappearance, detectives came across what could prove to be a significant clue, a glove found in a field near her home. And FBI officials now say it appears to match those seen in the surveillance video. DNA found on the glove has been sent for analysis. Marking 2 weeks since her mother was last seen, Savannah Guthrie issued another heartfelt plea.
And I wanted to say to whoever has her or knows where she is, it is never too late to do the right thing. And we are here. And we believe in the essential goodness of every human being.
Detectives have received thousands of tips from members of the public, leading to the search of at least two residential properties. But so far, none of those tips has led to an arrest.
The final set of hearings at the UK COVID-19 public inquiry begins today. It will look at the impact of the pandemic on society, with a focus on mental health, key workers, the most vulnerable, and those who were bereaved. The hearings are set to last 3 weeks. Gardeners are being asked to help the Royal Horticultural Society revive a rare pink daffodil species. The charity is inviting anyone who grows the flower to send bulbs to its research facility in Wisley in Surrey after they've bloomed this spring. Guy Barter, the chief horticulturist at RHS Wisley, says different coloured daffodil varieties are far more common than people realise.
Mrs. R.O. Backhouse was the first pink one that was ever invented on the Backhouse estate in Scotland, and we're very keen it doesn't drop out of cultivation. People think that daffodils are just yellow trumpets, but in fact, to the daffodil fancier and the keen gardener, there's an amazing array of daffodils that you can grow in all sorts of colours and shapes and forms, and I'd urge people come summer to gaze at the catalogues and try something new.
The former editor of British Vogue, Edward Enifil, will be honoured with a wax figure at Madame Tussauds today to celebrate London Fashion Week. The 53-year-old was the magazine's first black editor-in-chief and became the youngest fashion editor at a major international title at just 18 when he joined ID magazine. Edward Enifil said it was an honour to be recognised by what he described as a legendary attraction.
Thank you, Chris. It's 10 minutes past 8. Now, whenever we talk on this programme about children and screen time, the response from you is always huge. How to keep them safe, how to limit addictive scrolling, how to make sure that what they're accessing is appropriate. We're still at a stage where there are many more questions than there are answers, and the technology moves so quickly that safeguards and legislation are struggling to keep up. For many parents, dealing with the repercussions is one of the biggest issues in their lives. Well, this morning, the Prime Minister says that no online platform will get a free pass over children's online safety. The government's announcing updates to the Online Safety Act, closing loopholes that have grown since the law was written. But there are still criticisms that this is all happening too slowly compared to the pace of technological change. Well, in a moment, we'll speak to the Technology and Science Secretary, Liz Kendall. First, though, Zoe Kleinman is our technology editor. Zoe, what is new about today and what is still not quite being covered?
So there are plenty of laws designed to protect people using digital platforms, aren't there? We've got the Online Safety Act, we've got the Data Use and Access Act, we've got the UK's equivalent of GDPR. Today's announcement includes an update to the Crime and Policing Bill. So there's no shortage of laws, but there's a real patchwork of them. And of course, as you say, the tech is advancing more rapidly than regulation, and we keep bumping up against new issues as a result. What's kept changing today? The government says there are going to be changes to the way in which we deal with children's data if they die. So now coroners will have to notify the online regulator Ofcom of the death of every child aged 5 to 17, because it can then act quickly to make sure the tech companies don't delete their data if it might be relevant to the way in which they died. Some bereaved parents say they're struggling to get hold of their children's data to understand what might have happened to them. It's also looking at including AI chatbots in the Online Safety Act, because that was originally written for social media and search, and you know, started life before hundreds of millions of people were using things like ChatGPT. And it also says it's already announced a consultation. It's going to ask for opinions on things like a social media ban for under 16s, limiting doom scrolling, and restricting the use of AI chatbots for young people. So we already know that's happening. That's going to start in March. But what the government is saying is it wants to act quickly. It doesn't want to go through months of formalities if there's a clear direction that people want the government to go in. Now, that's interesting because that does address the criticism that regulation moves too slowly. But on the other hand, you know, that's quite a lot of power for politicians to be giving themselves to change laws without following those processes.
Zoe Kleinman, our technology editor, thank you. Well, let's speak to Liz Kendall, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology. Good morning.
Good morning.
How do you deal with the quick and the slow of all of this, as Zoe was identifying there? The fact that you want a consultation, but you also want to change things fast. How do you tread that path?
So what the Prime Minister will announce today is some immediate action we're taking. Firstly, making it automatic that we preserve data in the terrible event of a child's death. Ellen Room and other bereaved families have campaigned for this, and we're going to put that into legislation. We're also going to be closing the gap in the Online Safety Act around AI chatbots, which didn't exist when this legislation was passed. And we're going to take powers in the Children's Bill, which is coming through Parliament now, to enable us to implement the results of our consultation swiftly. There will be a vote in Parliament on this, so that MPs do get a chance to have their say on those proposals. But you're right. What we're trying to do here is have a proper process, which is, I do think, a consultation is essential, because there are different views about whether we should have a ban or not, but enable us to move swiftly with proper scrutiny. Because, look, if you think about it, the first time the Online Safety Act was sort of discussed and was put forward, I think, was in a green paper in 2017. That is too long. That process is way too long, because the technology is changing so quickly. And, you know, I would say MPs have a finance bill every year with a budget. I think we've got to think much more like that with technology, because it is changing so fast.
Which is why people really want that speed. I mean, you mentioned in there the Children's Wellbeing in Schools Bill, which has been amended in the Lords, we had Lord Nash on the programme earlier. Will that be able to pass back to the Commons? Will you give MPs a vote on keeping that amendment? You will?
Yeah, so we will take the powers to implement the results of the consultation. We will have a swift consultation, 3 months. We'll come forward with our proposals before the summer. And then there'll be secondary legislation, sorry to get technical, but there will then be a vote in on the floor of the House about that, because we believe, obviously, MPs want to express their views.
I know, and that's, I'm sorry, just for clarity, that's specifically on that amendment that the Lords passed?
No, that will be on the results of our consult.
So I was asking about the amendment.
Yeah, so that will come back to the House and there'll be a vote on that. But we are putting forward our own proposal, which is we do think it's right to have a consultation on whether or not to ban social media for the under-16s. Lots of people have made up their minds, Lord Nash included, but let me just say this. There are organisations, including the NSPCC and the Molly Rose Foundation and the Internet Watch Foundation, who are worried that a ban wouldn't solve the problem because it would just force some of this stuff deeper onto the web, that children would try and get around it, that it would create a cliff edge at 16. So I think it is the right and responsible thing to do to have a consultation. But I don't want to wait 8 years before, you know, an Online Safety Act Mark II.
I'm
sure need to be able to act.
Don't as well. I mean, going right back to the original point, when you're trying to deal with something like this with legislation, which is slow and cumbersome, and in some places, you know, necessarily so, but tech companies are going to be picking away. If you're patching the roof as you go with statutory instruments and all sorts of different bits and pieces, how will that last?
But if the alternative is 8 years before legislation is
but
even
maybe there's a different way. I think that's my question. Well, neither of those ways are ideal, are they?
That is what we're trying. That is exactly what we're trying to do here, to give us the powers to act more swiftly, to legislate right now on keeping data if in the terrible event that a child dies, making sure AI chatbots are covered by the Online Safety Act more immediately, because that's a real concern. Not only that there may be illegal content, but children developing these sort of personal relationships, deep relationships with an AI chatbot that could encourage them to do something that is harmful to them. We need to be able to act swiftly where necessary. There needs, of course, to be the proper scrutiny from Parliament. But the truth is this, technology is developing at pace. We live as much of our life online now as we do offline. Politics may sometimes seem to be terribly fast-moving and frantic, but in other ways, it is terribly slow. So we are finding a way to act swiftly where we need to, okay, to consult where it's right, so that we actually say we want to give children their childhood back, but we've also got to prepare them for the future, because a life online is part of reality now. The government needs to set the guardrails here. The accountability is on the tech companies, but government's job is to set the guardrails,
so
that's what we're doing.
A priority for you. I also want to ask you about Labour Together. We had John McDonnell, Labour MP, on the programme earlier. He says he's written 4 times to Labour's General Secretary and to the Prime Minister asking for an investigation to be launched. Is that something you back?
Well, the Cabinet Office will be looking at the facts around what's happened here.
Is that an investigation?
I would just say this, that the freedom of the press is absolutely essential for me personally, but for the government as a whole. And the journalists that were looked into here, they are journalists of great experience and great integrity. And they make our lives difficult sometimes, and rightly so. We should be held to account. So I think it's absolutely right that the relevant regulatory body that covers public affairs is already investigating this. The Cabinet Office will be establishing the facts around it.
Is that the same as launching an investigation, which is what John McDonnell says he's been rebuffed on 4 times?
Well, establishing the facts is the first thing that you've got to do on anything, isn't it? You know, if you want to look into something properly, you have to be able to establish the facts. It is the freedom of the press, difficult though it is, and is an essential part of the proper functioning of a parliamentary democracy.
This is a report,
and that's extremely important.
That was commissioned by Josh Simons, who at the time ran Labour Together, who is now a Cabinet Office minister. The current CEO of Labour Together says that she's horrified that this has happened. We spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times earlier on.
Oh, I didn't hear that interview.
He said, that's fine. I realise you've got other things that you have to do. Don't worry. We also spoke to the editor of the Sunday Times, and he said that that report was used widely around Westminster. It was talked about. It was used to smear the Sunday Times. It was used to smear its reporters. Is Josh Simon's position as the person who commissioned and paid for that report now tenable? Can he still be a minister in the face of
that? Well, he has welcomed the investigation, rightly so, by the regulatory body, the body responsible for regulating public affairs. As I said, the Cabinet Office will also be looking into the facts of this case. But it is absolutely essential that we protect the freedom of the press. The specific journalists involved here are, you know, of the highest quality and the greatest integrity.
So does his position remain tenable?
He is rightly welcoming the investigation that is taking place into this by the public affairs regulatory body. That is right. I believe that these issues are essential to protecting the freedom of our democracy, the freedom of our press, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more about this in the weeks to come.
Liz Kendall, Secretary of State for Science, Innovation and Technology, thank you.
It is now 8:21 and it is half term, and our book club Dynamic Duo are back with some tips, not just for books, but for a series or a box set to keep you or your tween turning pages rather than scrolling over half time. Yes, it's Frank Cotterill Boyce and Catherine Rundle who join us once again on the line. Morning to you both.
Morning.
Catherine, you've got, and I know you're not here to plug your own books, we'll get to other people's books in a second, but when you start something like the Impossible Creatures series, your such successful series, did you set out with that in mind? Was that the plan, that the hope?
Yes, I think that I wanted to give children the idea of a world that you could return to again and again. Because when I was young, I think that was what really gripped me. The twin pleasures when you get with each new book, both fresh discovery of a new plot, but also the familiarity of a world in which you can step back and into which you can explore in a way that feels both like you're discovering things that you have already anticipated coming and things that are completely fresh.
Now, I know the early Cotterill Boyce because the age of my kids, Frank, Millions Framed, which, as you've heard me say before, I love. I don't think you've done a series, have you?
No, I've never been blessed with such a great idea.
but that's the appeal to the reader as well, isn't it? Being in a world that you can return to again and again.
Yeah. And one of the ones I was going to recommend, obviously, Impossible Creatures is amazing and I'm very, very envious of it. One of the ones I was going to recommend was Joan Aiken's Wolf series, in which I feel she's going back like a child. She doesn't know what's going to happen next. They're completely wild. If you've read The Wolves of Willoughby Chase, you'll know that she can do these kind of amazing Victorian thrillers, but there's dozens of sequels to it that she wrote, and each one seems to me to be a surprise to her. They're full of mad ideas. There's kind of a version of Moby Dick in which there's a pink whale that's got a crush on the that loves the captain of the ship. There's a guy who steals a lake by freezing it and cutting it into bits, and you can feel that in each book she's gone, what about this? So she's like, she doesn't have the map, she doesn't have that kind of idea of where it's going, and it's a real ride. So they're wonderful books. The Wolf series by Joan Aiken.
Give us your first choice then, Catherine.
Mine is Diana Wynne Jones's Crestomancy series. There are seven. She started writing them in the late 70s. And they are wizard stories about a nine-lived enchanter. And the thing that is absolutely spectacular about them is that she salutes the intelligence of her readers. She is a great ironist, a satirist, a very generous storyteller, and she believes in leaving strange lacunae for the children, sort of ellipses, things which don't quite make sense, so that the child has to invent as they go along. And so a Diana Wynne Jones book feels a little bit like you own it because you too participated in the building of it.
Frank, it's a reminder, isn't it, that there's lots of great new writing, but it's also a joy to go back to some of the classics.
Yeah, I've got, well, absolutely. And I think what's lovely about this particular age group that you've picked is that they're on the brink of going into the grown-up world of worry. And if people like Diana Wynne Jones or Joan Aiken can keep you in childhood without patronising you for a minute. So I was going to suggest one more classic, which was, everyone knows this, it doesn't need me to explain it, but you might not think of it for this age group. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Ah, we should say tweens for people who don't know tweens. It's not quite young adults yet in terms of children's.
Yeah.
Books. Yeah.
Yeah. So still able to be enchanted if the enchantment is strong enough. How about that?
Yeah. So Hitchhikers, another from you, Catherine, if you would.
I think more recently, Robin Stevens's Murder Most Unladylike series has given a lot of people aged between as young as 8 and as old as 18 a huge amount of pleasure, as has the Dragon Mountain series by Katie and Kevin Tsang, which again, like Frank says, it can enchant kids just as they start heading into older books because the enchantment is strong enough.
And one more from you, Frank.
Yeah, I was going to suggest Amari and the Night Brothers by B.B. Alston, which is a terrific story about a girl whose brother has gone missing and she finds that he's become involved in the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs. Well, there's mermaids. Yeah. It's amazing.
Lovely. This is going to keep us all busy over half term, Catherine. You've got time for one more.
Oh, well, in that case, my great classic. I think one of the finest series ever written in any language is Tove Jansson's The Moomins. I think it offers a profundity of insight into the human experience and is also strange and vertiginous and beautiful.
I thought you were going to say Narnia.
Oh, well, I mean, Narnia...
Is that a kind of, oh, of course?
I think perhaps I was saying Narnia is read. If you have a child who has not read Narnia, the day to change that is today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Three cheers for that. Frank Cottrell Boyce, Catherine Rundle, thank you very much indeed. I was lucky enough last week to see the new production of Shadowlands. We had Hugh Bonneville on the programme recently, talking of the life of C.S. Lewis. Wonderful play, wonderful performance.
There was loads of reading material to get started on there, wasn't there, for half term? Carthy's back with the sport, hello.
Plenty to watch at the moment as well. We had an historic day at the Winter Olympics yesterday, the first time Great Britain has won two gold medals in a single day. Charlotte Banks and Hugh Nightingale won the snowboard cross mixed team event. That's a first ever gold medal for Great Britain on snow. Matt Weston and Tabby Stoker became mixed team skeleton Olympic champions, with Weston becoming the first British athlete to win two gold medals at the same Olympic Games, Winter Olympic Games, that is. Nick spoke to them earlier on the programme about how they got into skeleton and the dangers of it after Weston broke his back twice.
Yeah, as you can probably imagine, skeleton isn't the most safest of sports, but it's a hell of a lot of fun when you get it right.
Yeah, Tabby, tell us about it, because you were a circus performer originally, weren't you? What on earth induced you to lie flat on a tea tray hurtling down at that speed?
Yeah, I guess the circus definitely prepared me for the adrenaline. And then we had a talk with Lizzie Arnold when I was first starting the programme, and she just like sparked some inspiration in me, the fact that maybe one day we could achieve the things that she had. And I guess just with skeleton, the rest is history, you know, competing and learning to love and cherish the sport.
Plenty more on the Winter Olympics on tomorrow's programme with Eddie the Eagle as my guest. Now, Arsenal reached the fifth round of the FA Cup with a 4-0 win over Wigan. Wolves edged past Grimsby Town with a 1-0 win. All results are on the BBC Sport website, but let's catch up with the BBC chief football writer, Phil McNulty, who's been across all of those games at the weekend. I suppose, Phil, in the absence of a huge shock so far, VAR has been the talking point. There is no VAR this season until the fifth round. Why is that, and what issues have there been over the weekend?
Hi, Carthy. Well, VAR has always been a contentious issue ever since it was introduced. People have been complaining about delays and too much interference, sucking the joy out of the game, and still questions over whether decisions were right or wrong. And the big controversy over the weekend, even without VAR, the big talking point was the game between Aston Villa and Newcastle United, when three major decisions were highlighted. Tammy Abraham was clearly offside for Villa's goal. Villa defender Luca Dean was then very fortunate to escape a red card for a late challenge on Jacob Murphy. Then, probably worst of all, a free kick was awarded outside the box when Dean clearly handled the ball yards inside the box. It was a very difficult night for referee Chris Cavanagh and the officials. And Wayne Rooney actually said on Match of the Day that the last one, the free kick that was given outside the box, was possibly the worst decision he'd ever seen. It certainly opened up a debate about whether VAR has become too much of a comfort blanket for referees, whether they're now too reliant on it, and they're possibly losing the art of making big instant decisions without it. In fact, it was probably the best advert in favour of VAR for a long time. Although Newcastle at least didn't pay the penalty because they did win 3-1.
Yeah, it is a very interesting debate, isn't it? There were 14 fourth round ties. As I mentioned, you know, no massive shocks. League One side Mansfield Town came from behind to beat the Premier League's Burnley 2-1. They reached the fifth round of the FA Cup for the first time since 1975. And tonight we have sixth tier Macclesfield. You're at that game later. They face Brentford, who are seventh in the Premier League. Does that feel like a fixture that has the potential for an upset?
Well, we've seen Macclesfield, what they did in the last round against the holders Crystal Palace, and it's got all the classic FA Cup tie ingredients, hasn't it? Sixth tier Macclesfield against Brentford, as you said, seventh in the Premier League. And Macclesfield, as you say, have already provided notice of what they could do by knocking out the holders Palace in the third round, overcoming a gap of 117 places on the game's ladder. Certainly, I think for Brentford, that's a case of forewarned is forearmed, as they know what can happen. And Moss Rose will be packed to the rafters again. And as I said, it's a game with all the classic FA Cup tie ingredients.
Enjoy that match. Phil McNulty, thank you very much. Hearts' lead at the top of the Scottish Premiership is down to 2 points after they lost 4-2 to second place Rangers. Manchester City remain 8 points clear at the top of the Women's Super League. And a few other headlines in the Six Nations. Wales lost 54 points to 12 to France. Scotland had a 31 points to 20 win over England. And Ireland beat Italy. While in the Cricket T20 World Cup, India beat rivals Pakistan by 61 runs. That was a match that only went ahead after the Pakistan government lifted a request for their team to boycott the game over security fears. And this morning, England face Italy at 9:30, and there's commentary on Sports Extra.
Cathy, thank you very much indeed. Start the week coming up at 9 o'clock. Here's Tom to tell us all about it. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Nick. The Booker Prize-winning novelist George Saunders is with us this morning. Wonderful talker for any listener who's never heard him live. He's back to the unsettling threshold between life and death that he explored in Lincoln in the Bardo in his new novel, Vigil, in which a dying oil tycoon finds himself in a tug of war over his immortal soul. Also with us, the journalist Oliver Bullough, whose new book is about the continuing arms race between financial regulators and the world's money launderers, and the novelist and writer Ecce Tamilkar, making the case that we're going to need a much better definition of home if we're not all to end up as strangers in a polarised world. That's start of the week, just after nine.
Thank you, Tom. The weather today, windy, some scattered showers around, most of them in the north and the west.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 28 minutes to nine. Chris Aldridge has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer says no online platform will get a free pass on children's safety as the government moves to close gaps more quickly in online protection laws. The Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, told us the internet was changing very quickly and legislation had to adapt. She defended the decision to hold a consultation on stopping under-16s from accessing social media rather than impose an outright ban, saying it was the right and responsible choice. Liz Kendall also said the Cabinet Office was going to establish the facts after the think tank Labour Together commissioned a report that investigated the personal backgrounds of several journalists. The group asked a US lobbying firm, APCO, to examine the origins of a Sunday Times story about its donations in 2023. Labour Together's then leader, Josh Simons, who's now a Cabinet Office minister, says the firm went beyond its brief. APCO says it's reviewing the work. The BBC has learned the Prime Minister is considering boosting defence spending to 3% of GDP by the end of this Parliament. It would come at a potential cost of up to £14 billion a year.
Chris, thank you very much indeed. 27 minutes to nine now. Alexander Litvinenko, Sergei Skripal and now Alexei Navalny, all murdered by Russia, all poisoned, all victims of the use of illegal chemical weapons. That is what a series of Western countries asserted yesterday, with the Foreign Secretary and her counterparts from Sweden, France, Germany and the Netherlands disclosing evidence that showed that the leading dissident Alexei Navalny's body contained poison taken from Ecuadorian dart frogs. And the news came 20 years after the world witnessed the slow, painful and public death of Alexander Litvinenko after he was poisoned in London with polonium-210. We're joined by his widow, by Marina Litvinenko. Good morning to you, Marina.
Good morning.
I imagine hearing this news forces you yet again to relive what you went through, what Alexander went through 20 years ago.
Yes, and of course we're not doubt how Alexei Navalny died. We all knew he was killed. And news about of his poisoning brought me back to my days when we knew from beginning, after Sasha's death of my husband, he was poisoned, he was killed by Russia state, but we couldn't say this immediately. I should wait for 10 years. Only in 2015, after public inquiry, we can say, yes, it was Russia state. It was highly likely Putin's order. But now we should not wait for so long to blame Russia again for this murder.
There was a sense with the horribly public death of your husband that Russia, the Kremlin, wanted the world to know what it would do to those it regarded as its enemies. Do you think the same is true with Alexei Navalny?
Again, Alexei Navalny was a political leader of opposition inside of Russia, and he believed only being inside of Russia might be useful and effective, and maybe why he decided to come back to Russia. My husband was a professional man. He knew this system from inside, and he always tried to prove how the system is dangerous. Many years ago, now we say 20 years ago, but it was always difficult to make this decision for all countries to take action against Russia. But now when we have this, what happened to Alexei Navalny, and after that, what happened to my husband, what happened to family of Sergei Skripal, and now what happening to many Ukrainians people during this war in Ukraine. It means this is like a last drop with death of Alexei Navalny, with his poisoning, with his assassination, with torture. All world need to take more action now.
More action in what form? What do you want to see happen?
What I said is just not death. Even one person, it's a horrible event for family, for friends, for people who supported Alexei Navalny. But it's another case for what we already counted, what system under Putin just provided. And I think we now can say exactly Russia is a state that supported terrorism. I know it was saying from very beginning of war in Ukraine in 2022, but it was mostly saying as a political view. But I think we need to discuss more in a legal way. If we blame Russia supporting terrorism by killing people on this way inside of Russia, outside of Russia, it needs to be charged more serious. I know we don't have this legal rights what has United States, and they had a very strict immediate actions and sanctions against states like Iran, as is North Korea, Sudan, but this should be something done in European Union.
Yes, you want to see more sanctions, presumably less purchasing of oil by the European Union. Do you sometimes despair that two decades after the murder of your husband, so long after the murder of Sergei Skripal, the treatment of Alexei Navalny, we're now talking 4 years into the invasion of Ukraine, Europe has seemed to lack the resolve to really take on the Kremlin?
I can't blame European Union and even United Kingdom for doing nothing. But every time, or it was too late and we've been behind, or it was not so effective. And even my husband, Alexander Litvinenko, always tried to say, you have front of you, not exactly enemy, but is not a person you might happy to negotiate. Because former KGB officers, they always try to recruit you. And any chance they see you are weak, it means they are started to push forward more and more. And what we see exactly with the death of my husband, Sergei Skripal, assassination of political opponents inside of Russia, this is always was like that. Every time when you give a chance to this regime, you might lose. And this is what I exactly said. European Union and United Kingdom need to be independently very strong what they want to do with Russia. I know Russia is very close. Very close is almost a neighbor. But it means only strong power might make you be able to talk to Putin.
Marina Litvinenko, I'm sorry. Thank you very much indeed. It is the second anniversary of the death of Alexei Navalny, hence the timing of that assessment. And his mother has been talking to journalists in Moscow today, including from the agency AFP. And she says, it's just been reported that this confirms what we knew from the very beginning. We knew that our son did not simply die in prison. He was murdered. She goes on, I think it'll take some time, but we'll find out who did it. And of course, we want this to happen in our country. We want justice to prevail.
It's 20 to 9 now. The end-of-life charity Marie Curie has published new research this morning showing that tens of thousands of people are spending their final days in pain and in distress without the vital support that they need. The government has said it's working on a framework for this, but it's not due to be published until the spring. Well, Dr. Sam Royston joins us, Executive Director of Research and Policy at Marie Curie, and Brad McLean as well, whose son Stanley died in 2012 at the age of 18 months. Brad's Chair of East Anglia Children's Hospice Trustees and also a trustee for Together for Short Lives. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sam, tell me first of all, what have you found in this research? What kind of thing are people going through at a time when they need the greatest support?
So good palliative care for people living with terminal illness is about ensuring that they have the care and support that they need to die well. It means proper pain relief, managing symptoms and emotional and psychological support. And it's also about things like coordinating care, so families aren't left navigating services alone. And this research found that around 170,000 people in England each year spend their final days without the care and support that they need. And shockingly, it also showed that unmet palliative care need is expected to rise by as much as 23% over the coming 25 years without further action. So by 2050, we could be seeing more than 200,000 people in England each year dying without the care that they need.
And what are the reasons behind that? Why aren't people getting that support?
Well, an awful lot of this is about a lack of support out of normal working hours. So even if people can get support kind of day to day during working hours, actually, in the middle of the night, when they're facing unbearable pain, they're unable to get the care and support that they need and are left with no alternative but to call 999 and have a response from emergency services. So one of the things that we're calling for is for everyone to have access to 24/7 support, a single point of access for palliative and end-of-life care, so that people, when they need help in the middle of the night, they're able to get that care where they need it. And we also need to see a recommitment to palliative care being fully embedded in all neighbourhood health services so that people can get it in their local community where they need it and where they want it, rather than too often the case, ending up unnecessarily in hospital where it's the only place that they can get the care that they need.
Brad, you first got in touch with us on the programme a few years ago, and we've spoken to you since then, but in your experience, what you went through with Stanley, what do you need at a moment like that? What are the really key things that just help at an unimaginably difficult time?
Well, the biggest point that we received was the aftercare. So when our son had died, getting a knock on the door from East Anglia Children's Hospices to offer us bereavement support. As parents and family members, you have no idea what to do, where to turn. So that was without question the biggest thing that we ever received. And that goes on forever. You know, when you lose a child or any sort of family member, the grief side of it carries on. We think of end-of-life care being finished once that part's done, but it goes on for years and years. And for us, looking back, that's the most important part we received.
Yeah. And what are the challenges you're finding now, Brad, in terms of providing that sort of care to people who need it?
It's exactly what Sam sort of mentioned. It's a bit of an awareness piece. There's the funding, and we've spoken about funding for years. There's a serious lack of funding. There's a lack of workforce. There's not enough nursing, not enough specialists within the hospice sector to be able to deliver the care that's needed. There's not enough awareness. We're missing NHS, within paediatricians, doctors, GPs, the community, on signposting to palliative care and to the local hospices' support to be able to help these families, these people through these incredibly difficult times.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, hearing you describe that, you think about it, at those moments, you don't necessarily always have the energy that you would have at other times of your life to go and search for help or to search for solutions. You really need somebody to take care of you, to present them to you, don't you?
You do, and you would expect some of that coming from the doctors. When you go to a doctor and you get this horrible diagnosis, to not just be left out the door and to have to fend for yourself. The signposting needs to be done. The organizations, the charities, the hospice sector is there. And we just need more awareness to be able to signpost people quicker. When somebody's been diagnosed with an end of life, it's days and hours that are critical. Waiting for weeks to try and find that support yourself is just unacceptable.
Thank you both. Really appreciate it. Brad McLean and Dr. Sam Royston.
8:45. I should just correct what I said a few moments ago, which is there was, of course, an attempted poisoning of Sergei Skripal and indeed his daughter Yulia. But they, while poisoned, did both survive that attempted murder attempt. Dawn Sturgis, a 44-year-old mother from Salisbury, did die after being poisoned by a discarded contaminated perfume bottle. So my apologies for getting that wrong. It is now, 8:45. Now, you might think Wagner doesn't need a lot of help to grab your attention. But some of those attending the Royal Opera House's latest production of The Ring Cycle might be a little taken aback by the sight of a naked woman on stage for most of the performance of Siegfried, the third of The Ring Cycle. She is the actor, the 81-year-old grandmother, Ilona Linthwaite, who plays Erda, or Mother Earth. And she joins us in the studio. Morning to you.
Good morning.
Forgive me for mentioning your age. It sounds very impolite, but it seems relevant because the character of Erda, Mother Earth, doesn't sing a great deal, but is very important.
She is important, and she's thousands of years old. And also, I'm very glad you mentioned my age, because I think it's important.
Because?
Well, because I'm appearing naked as an 81-year-old, and I think it's something to be proud of, actually. I don't like to think of showing my body off, but I just want to make the point that women of this kind of age shouldn't be ashamed.
And when it was first suggested to you, because it's not traditional in most productions, is it?
No, it's not.
Sort of gossamer veils for the Mother Earth character often. Were you surprised? Were you worried?
I was, yes. I was deeply worried, but I've always wanted to be an actor at the Royal Opera House because I love music, and the idea of being on stage with people singing this near is very, very exciting.
It's and glorious, actually.
It is glorious, and I didn't know Wagner, and I wanted to know Wagner, and Die Walküre was the most extraordinary, deep, profound experience, actually.
I was lucky enough to see it was a wonderful performance. And the truth is, I think I'd read about it, but there's a little bit of surprise when it's when the curtain goes up for that. There you are.
And that was the most terrifying moment for me.
I can imagine.
And especially as she starts to revolve.
Yes.
On that little revolve there in the middle of the stage.
And how do you deal with the nerves? I mean, it's nerve-wracking enough being on the stage in front of, what, more than 2,000 people. But being on the stage entirely naked is something that is bound to be frightening.
It is frightening, but it's like another costume, actually. And as soon as I came off into the wings, I couldn't get a dressing gown on fast enough. Because immediately I felt very naked. But on stage, I didn't feel naked.
Oh, that's interesting, because you felt you were playing the part.
I was playing the part and part of the story.
And did you end up, and do you think the audience ended up, thinking, fine, what's the fuss about? This is crucial, this Mother Earth figure.
I think some people really appreciated seeing a naked old woman on stage, especially other women. I'm not sure everybody enjoyed it. And I think quite a lot of people could find it offensive. I don't know. I mean, I never heard negatives myself.
I don't know about offensive, but they might find it unsettling.
Unsettling.
This is unusual.
But unsettling's okay, isn't it?
Well, we're meant to be challenged by art, aren't we? You know, we're meant to be challenged by opera. I've got a very odd question. Do you not get a bit cold?
Do Do you know?
Because you're on there. It's not like fleeting, is it? You're there for a very long time.
I never, ever got cold.
Really?
Mind you, that was a little later in the year, Die Walküre. So the next one, Siegfried, which is earlier, I'm not sure.
Yeah, you need they'll need to throw a blanket round you when you come off the stage.
And they do.
Yeah. And it is, for those who don't know Wagner, and perhaps only know that, the Ride of the Valkyries, would you recommend it? Because there are some people who find Wagner a little bit scary.
I would recommend it absolutely wholeheartedly, yes.
Yeah. Well, Elena, thank you very much indeed. I know you share the part.
Part with a lovely actress called Marcella.
Lovely. Well, credit to her too. Elena Linthwaite, thank you very much indeed for coming on Mother Earth there. And if you've not been to see The Ring Cycle, do, because it's fabulous.
It is 10 to 9 now. Gardeners are being asked to help grow numbers of a rare pink daffodil. Who knew that such a thing existed? Dr. Kalman Konyavesh is the Royal Horticultural Society's principal plant scientist. Good morning.
Hello.
These are very rare. And basically, the idea is that you're trying to make sure that these wonderfully rare daffodils don't vanish altogether.
Exactly. We are asking the country's gardeners to help us find three rare, potentially lost daffodils.
And which ones are they? They've got fabulous names.
Yes. So we have Mrs. Arrow Backhouse, which is the pink one you mentioned, with white petals and a pink corona. Mrs. William Copeland, which is a white double daffodil. And Sussex Bonfire, which is a yellow-orange double daffodil.
So what you need is for people to hear those descriptions and think, oh, hang on, there's something like that either in my garden or somewhere near me. Because what sort of areas of the UK would you find those in?
That's an excellent question. We don't really know. We selected these three daffodils because we have an idea that they have a difference of where or how well they still grown. Mrs. Arrow Backhouse, the pink one, we know is available in some specialist collections. Mrs. William Copeland was available in the United States a few years ago, and we know someone sourced bulbs from there. And Sussex Bonfire, we know very little about. So the chances of finding each of these are slightly different. So we don't really know where they might occur in the country, which is why I asked the country's gardeners to log any sightings, any they think grow in their garden that looks similar, that we can have a look at.
I see. So you really are trying to track them down. It's just fascinating because we think of daffodils. You know, there's so many of them, and there will be in just a few short weeks' time, so many of them around that we might look at and appreciate the colour and think, goodness, it's spring after all. But you know, perhaps not appreciate them as deeply as you're describing there, realising how many and varied they are.
Yes, so the daffodil register, which sits with the RHS, contains currently over 32,000 daffodil cultivar names. Many of these have been lost to changing fashions or diseases in the past, but we don't always have information, for example, like these three, how well they are still grown. So it's interesting to see whether we can find any of these and potentially bring them back to wider cultivation.
And if people have got them or find them, you want the bulbs, right?
If people find them, we have a website where they can log their sightings and send us some images. Those images we will sift through with an expert panel of daffodil growers, and we want to get back in touch with those who we think might have the right things and the right plants, and ask them for a bulb that we can then grow together in Wisley, so all of them can be evaluated on site as a living plant next year.
Good luck with it. Dr. Kalman Konyavesh from the Royal Horticultural Society. Thank you.
Now, as it comes up to nine, just chance to tell you that if you want some more classical music, not Wagner on Radio 3 Breakfast after 9 o'clock, but they're playing the opening movement of Dvorak's Second Symphony, which is a rare chance to hear the young Dvorak searching and adventurous, it says here. The echoes of the composers who influenced him. That's coming up on BBC Radio 3.
It's 7 minutes to nine. The former US President Barack Obama says aliens are real. The bombshell came in an interview with the podcast host and YouTuber Brian Tyler Cohen over the weekend.
A couple questions here. Are aliens real?
They're real, but I haven't seen them, and they're not being kept in,
Area 51?
Area 51. There's no underground facility, unless there's this enormous conspiracy, and they hid it from the President of the United States.
What was the first question you wanted answered when you became president?
Where are the aliens?
Where are the aliens?
Yeah, you can hear the way they're talking. There is a reason why that's not the lead story on the programme this morning. It's not quite the cast iron guarantee that aliens exist that some people would hope for. But he is, as he was saying there, a man who's been privy to secret information that most of us would never get to hear. Professor Lewis Dartnell's with us, astrobiologist at the University of Westminster. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are aliens real?
Ah, well, I'm an astrobiologist. I've chosen to pursue a career in the search for life on other planets, so yes, clearly I think so. But I think aliens is a slightly woolly term. And I think if you hear the word aliens, you might imagine the last Hollywood film you saw of bug-eyed monsters or yes, spaceships flying around. And astrobiology is much more about life in a more general context. So simple, single-celled, bacteria-like life on the surface of Mars, for example. So that's what I spend most of my time thinking about.
And do we know that sort of thing that you're talking about does exist now? Or are we still searching for it?
We're still searching for it. We've not yet found it. There's huge numbers of exciting space missions coming up to search for life, simple life, elsewhere in our solar system, whether that's our next-door neighbour planet Mars or Enceladus or Europa, some icy moons in the outer solar system. But we've not found unambiguous, uncontrovertible evidence just yet. Yeah. We're still looking.
You see, I'm a huge fan of space. Anything at all that's connected to it, I think it's brilliant. And the idea that not just in our near solar system, but the further and further away that you get, what are the chances that there are, as you say, you know, there might be bug-eyed creatures, they might look like us, but, you know, the sort of functioning life beyond the single-celled organisms that you're talking about?
So there's 3-4 potentially habitable worlds in our solar system. But when we look out into the galaxy as a whole, you know, there's 200 million stars out there. And what our telescopes already told us, there's probably more planets in our galaxy than our stars. There's a lot of real estate where life could have got started. So maybe on a sufficiently Earth-like planet, evolution's had the chance to get beyond pond scum, you know, boring bacterial type life, to something that's a bit more like your eye, you know, multicellular, potentially even intelligent, perhaps technological. Perhaps they are building spaceships and radio telescopes and might be trying to send us an interstellar tweet or Instagram and saying, hi Earth, let's have a chat, let's get to know each other.
Is it going too far to say it's more likely than not, given how many planets and galaxies there are, that somewhere out there there is a life form?
It's tempting to think that. I mean, when you're dealing with very big numbers, like the number of planets in our galaxy, but on the other side of the equation, there could potentially be very small numbers. We have no idea what is the probability of life getting started on a planet. And the fact that we're here gives us no information, because if we didn't evolve here, then we wouldn't be asking the question, right? So I think this is one of the reasons why it's so important to try to find life on Mars. Because if we do find life on our next-door neighbour planet that started independently, that gives us a very good idea that maybe the probability of life getting started is much higher.
Yeah. You talked about them trying to contact us, because it's sort of inbuilt in us to try and contact them, isn't it? You know, the idea that there might be somebody or something else out there, and the messages that we send out. Is it Voyager that's still out there somewhere in the
there's two Voyagers, there's
darkness of space sort of with an LP with all sorts of information.
And we've been beaming messages as well. We've deliberately transmitted messages saying a little bit about ourselves. And there's a whole academic area called SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, listening for radio transmissions beamed towards us, or maybe super bright laser pulses. But despite decades and decades of looking, we haven't found anything that is obviously artificial.
So go to the opposite end. If it is indeed a single cell that we find, you'll be
incredibly excited. It'll be on the front page of every newspaper in the world, and then people will forget.
Well, I was going to say, to those people, it's not what we were really kind of excited for or hoping for. Why the excitement? What would it then lead you to search
for? So personally, I'm a biologist, and every time we look at biology on Earth, we're basically looking at the same thing. There's slight variations, but everything on Earth is DNA-based. It uses proteins, it uses fatty molecules to make its membranes. Imagine finding life on Mars that is undeniably different. It is truly alien. It is biology built in a completely different way. And trying to, you know, look under the bonnet of that engine and see how it works, see how it is similar to us, see how it really is different. But also there could be technological and industrial spin-offs. You know, a lot of biotechnology today is from extremophiles, bacteria living in boiling hot pools of volcanic acidic water in very cold places. There could be a lot of money to be made from bacteria that can survive on the conditions on Mars that could apply to technology and industry back on Earth. That's not why I study it, but that is a potential spin-off.
I have a big question to ask and only about 40 seconds for you to answer, which is terribly rude of me, but I'm going to ask it anyway. The scientific community is very collaborative. And we heard President Obama there saying, well, unless there's a huge conspiracy and they keep it from the president. If somebody somewhere did discover it, would they share it with you, with everybody else? Is that what the scientific community is like, or would they just keep it and squirrel it away?
Absolutely. That's what the scientific community do. There's protocols put in place for SETI and sort of steps to follow if a signal is received. And I just can't see a secret as big as Area 51 having downed spacecraft or aliens kept in captivity. That's not going to be kept secret for decades. No, the governments can't keep the tax